have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
What?
If you like your doctor, you will be able to keep your doctor.
What difference at this point does it make?
If you're looking to make sense out of what's going on in the world today, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to Southern Sense Talk Radio with your host, Annie, the Radio Chick Ubellus, and featuring Curtis C.S. Bennett and the most interesting guests that you'll find anywhere on internet radio. And you can join the show and let your voice be heard by dialing 917-889-3675. So sit back, relax, and remember, Southern Sense is common sense.
When an emergency strikes, what's your first impulse? If your answer is run to the grocery store, you're likely to find chaos and plenty of empty shelves. So how do you avoid this? Well, it's simple. You use today to make a plan, to prepare for things that may happen. It's a hurricane, earthquake, blizzard, or even social unrest, especially in today's political environment. The practical place to start is by storing up food in your home. And I use My Patriot Supply for my food storage. If you don't have an emergency food supply, it's time to do so. Here's a great item that makes it really simple. A two-week food kit that comes in a rugged tote. And it's only $75 when you go to my special website, preparewithsouthernsense.com, or call 888-441-7290. This food kit includes breakfast, lunch, and dinners that will last up to 25 years on your storage shelves. So order now and prepare yourself, and then rest easy. So it's very simple. Just call 888-441-7290 or go to preparewithsouthernsense.com. You know what? Let's make it even more simple than that. You're listening to my show, and it's called Southern Sense, and you know you put a dash in the middle, southern-sense.com, and click on the icon, Patriot Food. Well, if you want to insist, you can still go to 888-441-7290 or go to my website, Southern Sense, put a dash in the middle, southern-sense.com. Be prepared.
All right, and welcome to another adventure here on Southern Sense. You're here listening live on Blog Talk Radio, SHR Media, iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, iHeartRadio. Now we're on Global Enlightenment Radio, GERN Radio, with Daryl. And I am your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with my co-host, courageous Curtis C.S. Bennett, and now joining us with Daryl. So, It does help if I unmute the two gentlemen. my bad. You know, I can never start off a show without screwing up somewhere along the way. So welcome, Curtis. Good morning or afternoon. What is it today?
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, man. It is out there. It's crazy. But we want to welcome Daryl also, who has Gurn Radio. So welcome, Daryl. This is now our third broadcast with your station.
Yes, it is. And you are doing wonderful. I mean, the people love you. I received messages like, I like this show. I'm like, well, good. Stick with it. Don't be discouraged by anybody or anybody else's sayings. If you love a show on this network or you love this network or you just want to follow a good show, stick with it because they're going to teach you something. This is all about knowledge.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. And, you know, we've got the chat room really filling up over here on Blog Talk Radio, and I've got it up over on Facebook and YouTube. So you can always find the connection by going to my show page, which is Southern Sense. Just put a dash in the middle, and I've got the link to SHR Media, Spreaker, YouTube, Facebook. It's all up there. And, Daryl, I do know that sometime around July 8th, I'm finally going to get the broadband installed. So hopefully within a week after that, we will have ourselves up with the new platform, and it's going to look really, really, really sharp. So if people like listening in, when they go to watch, it's going to look really nice, really cool. But again, welcome everyone to it. We've got ourselves a big lineup today. We're going to start off with our old friend Clarence McKee. He is now an insider on Newsmax. Clarence, yeah, he's got his blog there called The Silent Minority. We're going to have – you ever watched the Food Network's The Food Truck Face-Off? He is also the CEO and founder of Slapfish, a food chain. We're going to have Andrew Gruhl. Chef Gruhl is going to join us. Then we're going to have our friend Alex McFarland. He's going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about a lot that's going on with religious liberty and the Supreme Court rulings. And then we have Voices Against Trafficking, and she's also an expert on PTSD. She and her husband runs a homeless youth shelter for those at risk called Beulah's Place, Andy Berger. And then we're going to finish with our Heritage Foundation favorite. I shouldn't say that because they're all my favorite, Hans von Spakovsky, about all the stuff that is coming in and going on. And before we start off really with the show, I want to say that my prayers are going out to those that were in that condo that collapsed yesterday down just outside of Miami, Florida, in Surfside. There's still close to 100 people still missing. At this point, maybe presumed dead, but again, we also have in the chat room Joe Goldner. Joe, he's under there underneath The Truth Is Out There, Voice of the People. So, Joe, just keep us up to date here in the chat room and let us know what's going on, because he's saying because there were so many Israelis and Jewish people in the building, it could possibly be a terrorist attack. There's 150 people now listed as missing and 4 dead. So thank you, Joe, for keeping us update. But again, our heartfelt prayers go out to those people in the building there. Well, going to get myself started a little early here with the tears. Anyway, Curtis and Daryl, you know that we do start off each and every show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And today's dedication is going to go out to Captain Justin Williams Bedwell of Decatur County Sheriff's Office out of Georgia. His end of watch was Monday, March 1st of this year. And this is from the Officers Down Memorial page. And it reads, Captain Justin Bedwell succumbed to a gunshot wound sustained 2 days earlier following a vehicle pursuit of two brothers that started in neighboring Seminole County. The pursuit started when a Seminole County deputies attempted to conduct a traffic stop of a pickup truck for reckless driving. And folks, this goes to show some of the most dangerous calls are one that people assume to be the least. Domestic disputes and car stops are two of the dangerous calls for any police officer. And with this defund the police, they want to send civilians out to do this. And if police officers die in the line of duty of just a simple car stop, imagine what would happen to unarmed civilians. But I'll continue as it further reads. The vehicle fled and the occupants opened fire on the deputies who pursued them into Decatur County. The vehicle stopped in the driveway of a residence near the intersection of U.S. Highway 84 and State Road 310. And the occupants attempted to force entry into a home by shooting through the door. The homeowner returned fire, prompting the subjects to abandon their attempt to enter the home. As Captain Bidwell arrived at the area, one of the subjects opened fire on his patrol car with a .30-caliber rifle, striking him in the chest. A second deputy suffered minor injuries. One subject was arrested at the scene. The second subject, armed with the rifle and wearing a bulletproof vest, was arrested 12 hours later following a manhunt in the area. Captain Bidwell was flown to a hospital in Tallahassee, Florida, where he succumbed to his wounds while undergoing emergency surgery on March 1st. Captain Bidwell served with the Decatur County Sheriff's Office for 20 years. He is survived by his wife, daughter, and mother. And this is from Donaldsonville News. A blue and black fog fell over Seminole and Decatur counties on Monday, March 1st, when Decatur County Sheriff Officer Captain Justin Bidwell succumbed to injuries that were sustained in the line of duty on Saturday, February 27th, in Brinson, Georgia, while assisting Seminole County Sheriff officers in a high-speed chase where shots had been fired at sheriff deputies. Bidwell, a 19-year veteran of the Decatur County Sheriff's Office, was a patrol commander training officer and a highly valued member of the command staff. When I knew he was on duty, I knew everything was fine, commented Decatur County Sheriff Wiley Griffin. He was a fantastic shift sergeant, lieutenant, and now captain. Bidwell was named captain posthumously on Monday afternoon. Seminole County Sheriff Keith Elliott and Seminole County Sheriff's Officer personnel offered their deepest sympathies and prayers to Captain Bidwell's family and each member of the Decatur County Sheriff's Office family. Sheriff Elliott commented, I would also like to say thank you to all the many local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies from all over Georgia, Florida, and Alabama that sent officers and resources or called and offered assistance in the capture of the suspects responsible for the death of Captain Bidwell and the injury of Seminole County Deputy Garrett Wooten. Decatur County Sheriff Wiley Griffin and his staff did an outstanding job coordinating the search for the suspects and taking care of the needs of all the many officers on the scene. I cannot express enough thanks to all those brave, dedicated, and professional men and women for what they did and what they do every day for the citizens of all our communities. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp released the following statement on Bidwell's death. On behalf of all Georgians, the Kemp family sends our heartfelt prayers to Captain Bidwell's family, loved ones, and fellow officers in the light of this heartbreaking news. His heroic sacrifice and dedicated service will not be forgotten. The governor ordered the flags of the United States and the flag of the state of Georgia to be flown at half-staff on the state capitol building and in Decatur and Seminole counties on Thursday, March 4th, the day of Captain Bidwell's interment. Bidwell began his career in law enforcement when he joined the Decatur County Sheriff's Office on December 5, 2001, and was sent to the ABAC Police Academy. There, he graduated and returned as a certified deputy. According to Bidwell's mother, Georgia, he wanted to be a police officer since he was 5 years old. Bidwell followed his dream of becoming an officer and continued to train and educate other officers along the way. In 2015, he began training sex offender registration coordinators for other counties, along with the DCSO employees.
He was a primary field training officer, an FTO, and trained many of the younger deputies employed now in Decatur County. He liked to help people. He even wanted to go to CHAMPS, choosing healthy activities and methods promoting safety. It's a school and teaches kids. Bedwell's natural dedication to helping others was recognized in November 2013 by Governor Nathan Deal when he received a commendation. The commendation stated that Justin Bedwell of the Decatur County Sheriff's Office is an outstanding member of the public safety community whose dedication to services embodies the very best of men and women in uniform. The commendation details the night Bedwell assisted two young women from Florida in locating a missing family member. Bedwell went above and beyond what was required or asked of him, the commendation reads. Justin Bedwell has set an exceptional example for others in his profession and throughout the state through his devotion to fulfilling the needs of those he serves. And from Bobby Poevent, a Decatur County Sheriff's Office captain is opening up about losing his colleague and friend, Captain Justin Bedwell. Captain Brad Lambert talked to WALB News 10, Bobby Poevent, about his fallen friend. "It's a loss, a big loss, a very big loss," said Captain Lambert. Lambert gave WALB a tour of Captain Bedwell's office, even after he put a note on the late captain's office door telling others not to enter. "I don't want anyone going in there for any reason, and I just wrote a note on it and said, nobody enter that office." Lambert said he and the late captain spent a lot of time in this office together, talking, laughing, and cutting up, along with brainstorming on what they can do next to better help the people they serve every day. Those talks just might be what Captain Lambert will miss the most. "How does it feel to be in this office?" Poyovit asked. "Not sure," answered the captain. Lambert said Captain Bedwell was very knowledgeable about the sheriff's office, especially after working in several different departments over his almost two decades at the Decatur County Sheriff's Office. One of his more recent duties was helping direct traffic at a local school. Lambert said Bedwell was someone you can count on, especially when on duty. He would just go above and beyond. Bedwell was promoted to captain posthumously. Captain Bedwell's last call over dispatch is also coming soon, and it's something Captain Lambert is not going to look forward to hearing right now. "I get chill bumps just thinking about it. That's when it really sets on you. You won't see him again." Others sent out their sympathies to the fallen captain. "I had the honor of working closely with Justin in the early 2000s when we both worked on the Criminal Investigation Division. He was a very good person, always smiling, laughing, and telling jokes. He was very dedicated to our profession. I will never forget him." Bainbridge Public Safety Director Frank Green. At the request of the Decatur County Sheriff's Office, the funeral service was held on Thursday, March 4th, at Centennial Field with Reverend Stephen Webb and Reverend Thomas O'Fishin. Due to the ongoing concerns concerning COVID-19, those attending were asked to maintain the recommended safe social distancing. Justin Williams Bedwell was born September 4, 1972 in Memphis, Tennessee, the son of Terry and Georgia Williams Bedwell. He was a graduate of Bartlett High School BAC Police Academy. Justin served for almost 20 years with Decatur. He was a Methodist by faith. Captain Bedwell moved to Bainbridge in 1994 and made himself right at home. He was known as the class clown and a guy who loved cooking, animals, Legos, video games, Star Wars, and Disney. This opened doors for him to build relationships with anyone he crossed paths with, except maybe the dentist. He was not especially fond of dental visits. UT Orange was his favorite color, and Tennessee football was always a topic of conversations. Justin enjoyed life and lived every day to the fullest. He always seemed to be scheming about the next fun thing to do, and reading with Maddie was on the top of that list. Serving others was his nature, and the job he loved provided that opportunity on a daily basis. Family was his life, and you knew without a doubt you didn't have to be blood kin to be his people. Survivors included his wife, Catherine, his daughter, Maddie, his mother, Georgia. Bedwell, Justin was preceded in death by his father, Terry, and his grandparents. Today's show is dedicated to Captain Justin Bedwell. It is also dedicated to all the brave men and women who serve as first responders, be they law enforcement, firefighters, or emergency services. It is also dedicated to all the brave men and women out there that serve in our military from the birth of this great nation through today and into its hopeful future. We dedicate to each and every one of them this song by my friend Todd Allen Harrington, My Name is America. May God bless each and every one.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect them. I stand for my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand for. I'll be strong.
And we are back. You're here listening live to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio, SHR Media, iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, Stitcher, Speaker, iHeart, now Gurn Radio. I am your hostess with the mostest, the radio Chickie D, Eddie, along with my co-host, Curtis C.S. Bennett. And now also joining us, Daryl, the owner of Gurn Radio. Guys, oh my goodness, I was starting to crack up on the end of that one. Sometimes doing them is really, really hard. And trying to read and you're crying while you're reading, it's not easy. Not easy.
And it is. Because these guys go out every day and, you know, they don't know if they're coming home. I noticed in the chat room someone mentioning the fact that there was a Daytona Beach police officer that was shot in the head yesterday. And so you never know. You know, these guys put their lives on the line. And we ought to appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And having been there and done that, as I said before, some of the hardest jobs you get, you walk into, you think it's going to be a piece of cake. You go, you pull a car over, and unless you're on your toes 24/7, you go down. Domestic disputes, another high one for, you know, cops losing their lives or being severely injured. And, you know, whenever you go to you approach a car, you're checking to make sure the trunk is closed and locked, that someone's not going to pop out of it. You're looking in the back to see if the people in the back seat or someone hiding back there. You're staring into the front, you know, you're not, before you even approach the driver, you're trying to see into the front to see where their hands are, what's going. There's so many places that things can go wrong. And,
yeah, it's,
you know,
like, it's like being paranoid on steroids.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're going into a domestic dispute, you know, you're going to separate the couple. And usually if you're the one that's trying to calm things down, both of them will turn on you at the same time. So, you know, like I said, people think this is an easy job. They think defunding the police and sending out social workers in our place is going to save lives. It's going to cost even larger lives. Even larger lives. Matter of fact, there's two other people in the chat room with the former law enforcement experience, and they can attest to it. There's so many places things can just cock up and go wrong. And you know, these people are screaming to defund the police. You know, they have no idea what the job entails and the stress these officers go under. And we realize that when we approach someone, we are probably approaching someone on the worst day of their life. And even if we're having a hard day, we've got to keep that in the back of our mind and then try to do the best job we can. That's Joe, I just said that domestic disputes are extremely dangerous.
I just got to say that was the most touching thing I've heard. You know, you're right. This domestic disputes are the worst. But, you know, the most unpredictable thing in all of law enforcement is once you get in that car and you leave out that station, and the public itself can be number one job hazard. You don't know what's going on out there. I mean, what's in somebody's head. These people have been in shell shock for 2 years now with COVID and dealing with the stress of being in a locked room with someone for months and barely going outside, not seeing friends, not knowing how to communicate. And then you hit me with the death of the captain. And I'm sorry, but that was a needless death. Another one.
Yes.
Another was needless death.
Absolutely. But, what we're going to do here, let's bring our guest in on. We've got a friend of the show for a long, long time. I think since I started broadcasting, that's how long I've known this gentleman. So welcome aboard, Clarence McKee. Good afternoon, Clarence. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Can you believe I've now, in this coming month, it's going to be 11 years doing this, Clarence?
Phenomenal.
Can you? Oh, wow. You know? And it's known you that long. Never met you in person, but always have fun talking to you over the radio. Oh, man,
great.
I don't even know where to Yeah. You're now with Newsmax. You now have
right?
the insight over at Newsmax. Congratulations.
Thank you. In fact, I'm trying to finish a column today on to get out as soon as I can. Well, you know, the one, well, one that was up there for, they kept it up a long time, was about how Obama, not Obama, but Biden's white supremacy strategy is ruining the United States. It's going to be dangerous. And you see it happening every single day.
Guess what I have on the top of the pile to discuss with you is your article from earlier this month titled Biden's White Supremacy Race Baiting Dangerous for America. And they're still doing that. They're still doing that. You know, the most dangerous thing to America is white supremacy. No. Not the fact that we've got our borders are completely wide open. We have been locked down for a year and a half. We're just starting to get back out. You know, we're still dealing with voter fraud. We've got China rising. We've got Russia rattling its saber. We've got Iran rattling. No. The worst thing that could possibly happen. And now we have this building collapse in Florida, and I have a friend of mine in the chat room who lives not too far from that building that collapsed that says it's a possibility because of the number of Israelis that were in the building. It may have been a terrorist attack. So we still are dealing with terrorism possibly here on our own turf. So no.
Well, I hadn't given that much thought, but wow, a lot of people from Israel were in that book. In fact, it's right in the neighborhood of several Jewish temples. So it's a very Jewish area, apparently. But I hadn't thought about that. That would be very scary. I haven't seen that in the media.
No, but they were saying there was workers on the roof. Now, if those workers were infiltrated, which allowed them to do what they were able to do, you think about that, too.
Well, you take a look at, if you saw the video of the building going down, you know, when you see how when they take down buildings around the country and, you know, planned, orchestrated, and it's planned, do you notice how they fall just straight down, correct?
Yeah, right. Yes.
Just like the Twin Towers, but when they take down a building, when engineers do, it falls just like that one did, straight down, not blowing out, just comes straight down. Like you would think that something had been planted, but that's an interesting thought. Never thought of that, but it went down very, very, lot of methodology in it, wasn't it? It's amazing.
Yes.
Think about
it. And to bring down the second tower on there, it as I was watching it, it reminded me exactly of 9/11 and of construction implosions. That's what
implosion,
they call it when they bring down implosions. Yeah, and that was an implosion. You didn't see stuff go outward. If you thought it was a construction error, you probably usually see the building tilt or something.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it's a very scary thought. But Joe over in the chat room is going to keep us up to date. Matter of fact, Joe ran for sheriff down in Florida a couple of years back. So, yeah.
Good.
Oh, man. I don't know if you ever heard of Joe Goldner, but he's up in the chat room keeping us filled in. But I want to get back to this article about that you wrote here. And, you know, we were talking a lot about critical race theory. And
yes.
I had my recent Tea Party meeting. It became a hot topic. And then I get home and I'm seeing the Loudoun County School Board in Virginia with the parents, you know, bringing it up about, you know, teaching critical race theory and transgenderism to their kids. And, you know, they're trying to get the school board to listen to them and they cut the meeting off. And last night we had our county GOP meeting. And again, it's a really, really hot topic. You know, you and I grew up in an America where the civil rights movement gave us closer relationships between all people, making us look at each other equally, as Martin Luther King hoped for content of character. Today, we have people like AOC, Ilhan Omar, and all the other cabal throwing critical race theory and white supremacy at us and just trying to divide us. I think it's time that we push back and say, no, we're not going to let you separate us.
The country's doing that. I'm so glad to see these black and white parents. It's not just white parents in Loudoun County and around the country. Black parents are very, very upset that you're going to say that my little black kid is oppressed. You're going to teach him or her that they are victims, that they're never going to make it anywhere. There's nothing in critical race theory that teaches people about all the great successes of black people in this country that we have had. You know, the Mary W. Jackson, the first black female engineer at NASA, who was able to get that spaceship up and back with Neil Armstrong on it. She was the first black engineer at NASA. They named the building after her. Well, critical race theory doesn't talk about black successes. It probably wouldn't even talk about Barack Obama. It talks about the negative. And what about biracial couples, Annie? So you're going to have a kid come home at night, sit down and say to his white mother or white father, are you a racist? Am I a racist? That's devastating to these little kids. Instead of teaching unity, brotherhood, and how great the country is. Of course, we've had our problems, but what they're doing is preaching separation. Totally. What if a black woman had a television and said, I mean a white woman, saying that, oh, my God, I had a dream I was going to kill all white people and blow them apart. That's what that black psychiatrist said at Yale. Nobody complained about that, did they?
No, you know, no, not at all. Go ahead, Curtis.
I was listening to a little bit of NPR because I was riding in the car yesterday. And they were talking about CRT, critical race theory. And they so-called had the pros and cons. But the pros for it was supposed to be that, you know, the kid's going to be faced with this anyway. So the educators, we think we need to step in and tell them what it's about and what it means to them. And I'm thinking, when did that become the school's main directive to influence kids how to think about social issues? What happened to reading, writing, and arithmetic, the three R's? You know, if they would focus on that, we would, you know, lower the illiteracy rate in this country by probably 80%. But they want to focus on social issues. Like it's in their province to do so. You know, that's just how arrogant the left is, you know, that they feel that it's up to them to teach our children. What happened to the parents? What about their role in say in all of this? That's my spiel.
No, that's so true. It's a theory to have black people fail. It really is. And as I mentioned that, I might say, could plug in my old book, you know, How Obama Failed Black America and How Trump is Helping It. When you read that book and you talk about how bad Obama was on illegal immigration, Biden is 10 times worse. When you talk about abortion, how bad he was, Obama, Biden is 10 times worse. This guy, it's just a disgrace. And instead of teaching our kids A, Bs, and Cs, as CJ was saying, they're teaching them racism. It's very, very bad. You know, the United States is number 25 in math and reading. China's number one. So what are the Chinese doing while we're talking about critical race theory? They just sent astronauts to their own space station. You know, not an international space station. They sent astronauts to their own space station. So while we're over here all hung up on critical race theory and teaching these kids, the Chinese are on the way to not only the moon, they're going to beat us to the moon in 24 probably, and they're headed to Mars while we're getting bogged down in this what I call garbage. And they're starting it in the military, Annie and CJ. When you get the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff talking about white rage, next we'll have Navy SEAL units by quotas.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And we saw General Manili at the testifying and just shaking our head, you know, he's forgotten what it was to be out there out with a rucksack in the middle of a war zone. He's completely, I mean, I look at this and I'm saying, what are you doing to the men and women out there on the front line with this sort of bull crap? So you're going to turn around and pull critical race theory on me when the guy in the foxhole next to me is depending, I'm depending upon him to help and cover my back. What does it matter what color they are? It's a matter whether or not they shoot me or he shoots the enemy. You know, I would rather have him shoot at the enemy and be my buddy. I don't care what color they are. It doesn't matter. And we had a saying in NYPD, blue is blue. It doesn't matter. As long as you've got your fellow officers back, who cares? And this is how it should be as an American. As long as you can make the best strudel possible, who cares what race or color? It doesn't mean you're culturally appropriating anything. If you're Asian and you can make a German strudel better than I can, so what? Who cares? My stomach is going to be happy, and you're going to make some money off of me. Who cares? But instead, you do have to divide the nation. And, you know, Curtis mentioned education. And there's an article that came up today on the Daily Signal. See, I catch everything. There's a teacher out in California that's blowing it wide open. She said she wanted to become more involved in her school union. You know, she's been a teacher since, I believe, 1987. And she's done all the work in the classroom. But she wanted to know what it's like, you know, what the union does at their meetings. So she began to get involved. And she was shocked to see that they didn't talk about academics, how to make the classrooms better, how to make them more efficient and the students better. It wasn't about the students and helping them succeed in life. It was about political issues such as social justice, human rights, LGBTQ, XYZ issues. And their training sessions all centered around political issues, nothing about academia.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we've known all along, but I think the teachers themselves in the classrooms are starting to understand. And as you saw in that video that they were playing on Newsmax, as well as other – see, a little plug for you there, Clarence – other stations, the one teacher that was saying, I'm telling the students to challenge the teachers if the teacher does this. And yes. When we had our county GOP meeting last night, we were asking our state senator, and I already knew the answer because I already asked my school board, who went to school supervisor, who went up to the state supervisor, whether about we're going to allow CRT. And Molly Spearman sent out a memo to everyone, a public memo saying, absolutely not, and we will not take federal money. So we find out there's three counties here in South Carolina that the teachers are promoting CRT. So our state majority leader, Senate majority leader, was the speaker. He goes, I'm going to look into it. Good. So we went right up to the top. But here in South Carolina, your funding will be pulled if you teach CRT. And this is what we need state legislatures to do.
Well, they're starting in Florida, and I think the governor's banning it too. And that's what they need
to do. Yeah, I believe Florida and Texas, I think their states are starting to wake up and say, no, this is very divisive. This doesn't say, you know, one nation under God, indivisible. We no longer say the Pledge of Allegiance. It's racist.
I was going to say that. That's the next thing they're going to go after. But people are speaking up.
Yeah.
And also, we've got another big issue because the mainstream left-wing media is promoting this stuff. They really are, and it's just amazing. That's why the public, by the way, even greater numbers, disrespects the media. They don't trust them. But we're not getting the true story, and that's why you're reading things as much as you do, like the Daily Signal and Newsmax, and people have to be informed from the Epoch Times and other sources because they're not getting it from the media. Just take a look at Hunter Biden. My God, when he used the N-word, if that had been Donald Trump Jr., it would have been everywhere. And then here comes Hunter Biden again, referring to women now. And apparently someone was trying to find him some women for pleasure. And he said in his emails, no yellow. Well,
oh, really?
Did you hear that anywhere else but on Fox? No. So we're at a stage where we have to educate ourselves through programs like Southern Sense and Fox and Newsmax and Epic Times. But the people are not stupid. They're learning this stuff.
But we also need the alternative media. No, you can't. You cannot. But I was saying
public education, they talk about racism in this country.
Oh,
to me, one of the biggest reasons institutions is public education and the teachers' unions. Look at the poor little black kids. No education, treating them horribly, these Spanish kids. That is racism. That's not white segregationists who are the evils of the country. It's the so-called liberals who are doing this to our kids.
You know, the last several months with the Biden administration, you know, I thought it was bad. When Jimmy Carter was elected president, I thought there could never be any worse than him. Well, that was proved wrong with President Obama. And when I saw the division under President Obama, that really started to piss me off. And then you see it magnified coming into the Biden administration. But the swamp was working behind Trump the whole long time. And someone said something at our meeting last night, and we have a new gentleman that he was at my Tea Party meeting, and he ended up over at the County GOP because he's a member of the executive board now. And he's started the Young Republicans here in our county. And he happens to be African-American. And so, you know, this one individual, I will not name him because he's got a national name, and I don't want him trying to sue me for slander, began to ask him, you know, about outreach to the minority communities. And finally he said, you know, it kept on pushing, like, what are you doing to get more minorities? And all he said was, I'm going to speak the truth and let them come to me. I'm not going to go out there and grab them. Just get my voice out there. And if they hear my voice and it's in their heart, they will come to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then when our Senate Majority Leader came up to speak, he turns around and asks the question of the Senate Majority Leader that why more people like my friend that's now the chair of the Young Republicans are not going out to the minority communities. And you know what the Senate Majority Leader said? He goes, that's not his job. It's mine. It's mine to get the message out there and invite them in. That's my responsibility. But that's the whole thing. Everyone goes, you got to go out and you got to grab it. No, no, no. I'm putting my voice out there. And if they have it in their heart to listen and to hear and to think about it, they'll come to us. And they
are. That's what happened with Hispanics and with Trump, right? They saw and heard his message, and that's why they went for him in greater numbers than ever before. The Hispanic mayor, Republican mayor down in Texas, first time ever, Hispanic city, Hispanic mayor, Republican, because they see the message.
And you see Burton Jones in Georgia coming off of the Democratic ticket, running strongly as a Republican conservative. You see it over and over again. Brandon Strucker, walk away. It's the walk away movement. And we're seeing it as long as we can get our voices out there. So alternative media, such as Joe's here in the chat room, such as Daryl's station, Global Enlightenment Radio. I'm trying to push you, Daryl. the alternative is out there to catch columns like yours on Newsmax, to see you up on Newsmax. When those voices get out there and they say, wait a minute, this is starting to make sense. Maybe I've been sold the Kool-Aid. I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid anymore. You know, we've got double shot lattes here. Right.
It's a real shame. And the other big issue that, you know, that's hiding in the background is the joke in terms of Biden and Kamala Harris of this border situation. She goes to the border. Are you kidding me? Only when she wasn't going until Donald Trump said he was going next week. And then she's in El Paso. It's about about 600-700 miles from the Rio Grande where the real issue is?
1,000? Yep.
It's amazing. So it's a joke. It's going to be a joke. She may have to giggle over that because even the media knows that this was a big show. It didn't mean anything. It's just a PR stunt. And I'm telling you, this immigration, when the people see how many fentanyl overdoses we're going to have and how it's going to jump, because while they're letting all these people in on one side or in this area, the drugs are coming in down the street, right? Into our communities all over the country, and it's going to hit all of middle-class America, the suburban housewives who hated Trump so much. Well, they love their kids more, and they want to stop this border situation. All they want are new Hispanic voters. That's what all this is about. It's all it's about. It's a shame.
And if you talk to a Hispanic that's a legal resident, whether or not they are born here or became a citizen, they're not for this immigration because
exactly.
they see it's going to drive wages down. It's going to drive wages real down. And
that's right.
What's going to happen to jobs for Americans? You know, that's going to be out the window. And we'll already see it happen. We're seeing our economy in turmoil, and it's just going to cause it to implode. And those
that's
that
right.
are coming over are dependent upon food stamps, welfare, Section 8 housing, Obama phones, medical care, education. And then when they are incarcerated, then we're responsible for that. So the weight of the taxpayer that we are going to feel, and it's coming fast, folks. It's not coming 10 years down the road. It's coming to a neighborhood near you probably next week.
Yes.
And what the toll
there.
On the American public, it's here. It's here. And then you see what it does to our healthcare system in ways in which they're bringing, of course, more COVID-19, tuberculosis, rubella. Believe it or not, leprosy, you know, measles. You see all this stuff coming that we eradicated more than two decades ago from our nation is coming back. And what's going to happen to the average American citizen when you come in there? Plus what it does to the homeless. And this is another outrage. Our American homeless are being dumped out of the shelters onto the street to make room for these illegal aliens.
Mm-hmm. And then they'll get them hotel rooms.
Yes. If they're not enough in the shelter, then they go into hotel rooms. And they confiscate the hotel rooms. Wait a minute. Isn't that unconstitutional? Isn't that an illegal taking? Oh, excuse me. You don't have a choice. What? And then we'll take it a little bit further there, Clarence. Shall I say foster families? Foster families
oh, yes.
that are forced to give up the children they chose to bring into their home, and they may only have two or four children in the home, and instead they're saying, nope, we're going to take those foster kids out. We're going to put them back in the foster system, and you're going to take not two, not four, 20 kids. Wait a minute, I only have a two-bedroom home. No. You're taking all
wow.
of these kids. That is what was happening up in Portland about 2 months ago. Were they not
really?
Still doing it? I guarantee they're doing it behind doors. And the neighborhoods that have no idea they're getting these aliens, what they did in refugee resettlement to us, is going to look like a kindergarten game compared to what they will do with dumping these people in our neighborhoods without us knowing and without us being aware that they're coming and being prepared for them.
It's something like Marxism, isn't it? You'd think we're in communist China, right? Or North Korea. And that's where this is the kind of philosophy that's going through this government. And people will realize it, and they better, in the next election. And they're trying to do as much as they can before the 2022 elections. I know that. It's disgusting and scary.
And it's accelerating. But yet, if we speak out about it, we're the bad guys, we're the racist, we're anti-immigrant, and did I just get cut off?
No, I hear you.
No, I still
hear
you.
I heard someone drop. All right, well, hopefully no one really did, but I hear dropping in the background. Anyway, it's all right. But, you know, then they use word speak. They then change the vocabulary so that when you try to make a cognizant argument, they'll take your words and twist the meaning into something completely different so that you sound like you're the evil villain, and they're the good guy.
And you're
the wordsmith, Clarence.
It's dangerous. His, mine. They're changing everything in the world. First thing you do when you want to change a culture, you try to change the language and get all this new language in. If you don't speak their language, you're a bigot. If you don't say LGBTQRXZ, whatever it is, then you're against gay folks, transgenders. They're really sneaky about getting all of these things in, and then you hear politicians using it. And then you get newspapers adopting it, and then it's going into the classroom. And sooner or later, we're going to wake up. But it may be, I don't think it's going to be too late. I have a lot of faith in the people of the United States, and they know good and bad when they see it. They think they thought they were getting something when they got Biden, and they got more than they bargained for. It's a shame because the people who voted for him are getting what they deserve, but the people who didn't don't deserve this. And half the people, I think, who were so much against Donald Trump that they couldn't see what's best for them, they sure are now. Everything that he was trying to do worked. Immigration. And next week when he goes to the border, you're going to see a big contrast between this joke that Kamala Harris put on today, this charade, and compared to what the governor of Texas and the former president are going to do. They're going to go right into it. And Border Patrol will welcome them with wide open arms.
So I did not get a chance to see anything on TV about, you know, Queen Kamala Mela at the border. I'm assuming she pulled an AOAC.
She was at a border station, Border Patrol at borders, miles and miles away. As you said, 1,000 miles from the real action. And everybody knows it. 5 hours.
So she didn't.
Come on.
She did an AOC, a photo shoot.
Yeah, but the photo shoot was not a shoot. It was a picture of her walking around and talking with some Border Patrol bigwigs and other folks, and a congresswoman who said that El Paso was like the island that welcomed all of the people and immigrants, you know. But that was all it was. You'll see. It's just nothing like you see on Fox when these people wading in the water, almost drowning, and running across the border and running from highway patrol, crashing into ranchers' homes. That's the danger. And I'm telling you, Annie and CJ, here's what's going to happen. Sooner or later, these ranchers are going to say, I'm not taking this anymore. And if you come near my property, we're going to fire some shots in the air. And that's where it's headed. They're going to arm themselves. Or a rancher is going to be brutalized or hurt or brutalized by some of these guys.
You know,
they're already up in arms on it. Go ahead, Curtis.
When it comes to messaging from the left, they're good at co-opting a lot of things Republican. Say, for instance, Juneteenth.
No.
If they was just stick with the events and the facts and that moment in time in history where the Army, Union Army, rode into Galveston, Texas, to announce the Emancipation Proclamation to the people there, the slaves, and they were 2 years late getting the information. That's the fact, you know. I mean, they rejoiced, some of the people and whatnot. Reality is it didn't really free anybody because it wasn't law. It was an executive order. And on top of that, it didn't address slavery all across the board, only those in the southern states and not the border states that were neutral.
That's right.
And you know, now they're changing it to mean other things. And on top of that, somehow this is Pride Month. Now, all of a sudden, I'm seeing on television all these little snippets of these great LGBTQRSYZ people who were famous people in the movement. Now, I thought this was supposed to be Juneteenth month or something like that. And all of a sudden now I'm seeing all this rainbow stuff. It's like I'm in the Twilight Zone or something.
Why is it a Memorial Month for all the men and women that died for this nation?
Exactly.
I mean, isn't that something more to honor? Curtis, if you can, get ready to call our next guest in, okay? But, you know, they're celebrating all the wrong things. They're celebrating things that can sell good instead of things that are true to honor. And that's the whole thing. It's got to be the flavor of the month, Clarence. If it sells good, it sounds good. It may not smell good, but sell good.
That's a good point. Well, I tell you what. Just tell everybody to read my book, Annie, again. I hope you enjoyed it. But it's got so much in it about you know, it was called, you know, How Trump is Helping. Well, everything he did on immigration, I mean, my gosh, we had conquered it.
Oh, he forgot to do something. Hang on. All right, hang on a second. Did he get it? All right.
Hello?
All right. Just hold on just for a moment. Yeah, all right, Andrew, just hold on for a second as I say goodbye to my next guest. All right, Clarence, I will be speaking with you and let you know that I did have on the video a copy of your book playing with your smiling face. So, Clarence.
Thank you.
We love you.
Hope they all enjoy it at Amazon. Thank you very much. Good seeing you, talking to you. CJ, take care.
All right. God bless.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
Thank you.
Clarence McKee. Check him out at his own website, which is his name, as well as up on Newsmax, as Curtis is bringing our next guest on. But, Daryl, you know, something always has to go a little wrong. It's not a show unless something else goes wrong. Did I lose Daryl? That is probably the call that dropped. So anyway, let's bring our next guest in on, and I do have to apologize. We are having some technical difficulties, but hey, you can never get off a live show without having something go wrong, and that's the beauty of media. So let's welcome Chef Andrew Gruhl. Good afternoon, Andrew, and how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it is our pleasure. And like I said, you know, if you do something live, always expect something to flub, right? Always expect something to happen.
Good times.
Yeah. Now, tell us, because I don't know if all my audience watches the Food Network, but you have some fantastic shows up there. But how have you been able to do this? Have you still been able to film with this COVID pandemic and everyone having a great panic over it?
Yeah, yeah. We, you know, I haven't been doing anything with Food Network as of recently. Those were a few years back. So my main focus has just been on the restaurant empire and trying to get through the pandemic with all the restaurants across the country.
Now, I have to admit, you know, I've been seeing this locally, you know, restaurants closing left and right because they're not allowed. And when they are allowed, you can only have 5%, 10%, 20% sitting inside. Oh, no, you can't sit inside. You can only sit outside. And the restaurant business is one of the hardest businesses. And most businesses, when they open, they'll know whether or not they succeed within the first 6 months to a year. A restaurant takes as long as 2 years to know whether or not you can get established and become something good. So it's not an easy business. It's very work intensive, and people don't understand that. So now how are you able to survive? Because you've got Slapfish, and you've got 20 restaurants that you have. You know, have you been able to keep all of them open, or are some of them saying, well, I'm throwing my hands up, I got to walk away?
No, we had to shut one of them down. So we have 28 restaurants of the Slapfish enterprise, and then I've got another 4 restaurants that my wife and I run. We did lose one of them. Yeah, it's been difficult. I mean, it's been incredibly difficult, and the seeds are now planted for it to remain difficult. And they're not doing anything, local, state, and federal governments, in order to open up the highway, if you will, and create a business environment where we can flourish again. It's only becoming more and more and more restrictive. And already the existing regulations were so intense to begin with that they were forcing a lot of the small guys out. And now we're seeing that happen at a rapid pace where independents, right, all of our restaurants are independently owned franchisees of the system. And it's really, really difficult for the small guys to operate in this environment.
Yeah, and if you're a franchise owner, you know, your own money goes into it. And it's as if you have a small mom-and-pop, you know, restaurant. And basically that's how you handle it. Everyone's like family, you know, so it's just mom-and-pop, and this is aunt and uncle, and everyone's family. But, you know, you can only just go so far. You know, here in South Carolina, thankfully, everything is wide open. So restaurants are full service. But you have states such as New York, California, and so forth that are still highly restrictive. This is not just, you know, whether or not an owner keeps his business open, but it's the employees. It's the tax revenue that also benefits the neighborhood. And it snowballs, and people don't understand that.
Yeah, but it's also not even, it's now gone further than just the specific restrictions, right? So, you know, even for those states that are opening back up again at full capacity, what's happened to the mindset of the consumer is that it's been crushed with fear. There's panic porn out there right now, everywhere, and they can't let it go, right? It's the new variant. It's this, it's that. Oh, are we going to shut down again in the fall? And it's the messaging from the government officials to continue scaring us that's keeping people from going out to eat. And that's also hurting restaurants. And that's where I talk about this crippling effect by virtue of what they've done to the consumer psychology through this fear, you know, inciting sensationalism in every single headline that you read.
Yeah, so now you have a restaurant that's able to produce the food. You don't have a staff because the staff workers don't want to come back. They're getting paid more to stay home. And then you have the public out there afraid to walk in. So now what you can do is probably do delivery, but you then have Uber, Meal Dash, and half of the other different services out there that say, wait a minute, you know, I can get a hamburger from this restaurant and it'll be cheaper and I make more money than I get it from yours. So it opens up a whole different field of competition that you have to fight against.
The meal delivery services take 30 cents on every dollar. So that does nothing for restaurants. That's just a pivot. That's a temporary fix. That's not a long-term solution. And it's been presented to restaurants through this pandemic as a pivot opportunity, a long-term solution. And all it does is just push a restaurant further into the red, if you think about it. But the average restaurant's profiting 5 cents on every dollar, and now you're giving up 30 cents on every dollar. You're at negative. Nobody's covering that nut. Nobody's covering that difference. It's not like you then present that to the government and ask for tax rebates on it. They're not rebating anything. So that's a short-term solution. And then the other option for these people that don't want to go out, right, as you just described, is they buy everything off Amazon. And that's where we've seen that the rich have gotten richer and the middle class has been virtually exterminated throughout this entire thing.
Oh, then you have those monthly services that they'll send you a box of food and it's easy for you to prepare at home, just like a chef does. You know, please. I mean, I looked at some of those meals and I said, I can throw that dish together better and at half the cost here in my own kitchen. But what that does that do to the restaurant owner that created that dish that this other company is now imitating and mailing in a monthly package subscription to a homeowner? And they're attacking the restaurant business in so many different areas, and God bless you for trying to stay open. But on top of that, with your own problems and your own fights against government and getting business back, you started a charity, 86 Struggle. And if anyone doesn't know what 86 means, and I used to work in a restaurant, I used to waitress, bartend, and so forth. So you 86, it's out, it's gone. So you started this to help people that were hurting because they can't get back to work.
Yes. So we started it in December when they shut down outdoor dining again here in California because people weren't able to get their unemployment benefits. The whole entire system had been the victim to typical fraud that you see in any of these large, bloated, bureaucratic, government-run systems. And they misappropriated upwards of $40 billion in funds here in California. And then there were employees who were unable to get any unemployment checks right after the government said, hey, by the way, you're closed. You've got no job. This was going into the holidays. People had to decide whether they were going to buy Christmas gifts for the kids or put food on the table. So we started the fund to try and help that group of people. We've raised about $400,000 to do so, distributed all of it already.
Wow. Now, are you able to get staff back at all? Because here in South Carolina, not until the end of this month that those little extra benefits and everything will end. So at the end of this month, I'm assuming right after the July 4th holidays, a lot of people will be looking to get back to work.
Yeah, it's difficult right now. It's really tough out there. Between that and the supply chain issues, it's certainly a whole new barrier for the restaurant industry or retail in general.
And now that opens up a whole new can of worms, the supply chain issues. And that was really exposed with that ransomware attack against the meat industry by the Russians. And it's affected the whole food chain. So you're trying to get stuff in. How do you serve food, even if you do have a customer in, if you can't get the food?
Yeah, and that's what we're seeing around the board. So, you know, for everybody listening, just be patient because all restaurants are dealing with it, from staffing to product issues. I mean, you're seeing half menus out there because people can't get the product in. Price increases are coming if they haven't already hit in some restaurants. You're going to see at least a 20 or 30% increase in prices. We're, you know, this is, you know, government-stimulated inflation right now, and it's we're living in the midst of it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And when I hear you say, you know, price increase, it brings me back to one of those old Perry Mason where he's sitting down there with his secretary, Della Street, in this nice restaurant, and the coffee was 5 cents a cup. And back then, you got to remember, coffee was only a nickel. He's like, what are they putting the coffee for 5 cents? This is what people are going to think, that you're just jacking up the prices. But there is a reason. There is a reason how you calculate those prices. You know, you have to worry about your rent for your building, the insurances, the cost of the food, the cost of the maintenance, the cost of the staff. You have to add all these things in and then have something left over to pay Uncle Sam. So it's not an easy calculation.
Yeah, if you think about it this way, on average, if a restaurant would make 5% or a nickel on every dollar, right, and now our labor costs have gone up 5% and our food costs have gone up 5%, now we've got to cover that with another with a 10% increase in some way, whether it's cutting portions, whether it's increasing prices, products. I've seen a lot of restaurants do that where they've compromised on quality and they're buying lower quality ingredients in order to try and keep the prices the same because they don't want to deal with the consumer pushback. You know, that's the funny thing is that everybody wants to be, you know, everybody wants to be an armchair restaurateur. And nobody's willing to pay the prices when the economy does what it does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm trying to get my thoughts together here. So I apologize. There's something else that they've been doing. They did this starting in New York. Vaccination, you know, mandatory vaccination, some people are calling, which is absolutely illegal. But if you don't get the vaccination, then we're going to segregate you. They did it with the baseball games. They did it in several other fields. Now they're doing it in restaurants that, you know, you can't sit in the same side. We're going to have a separate section for those that are non-vaccinated. So what happens with a family that walk in, mom and dad are vaccinated, the kids aren't, so you can make the kids sit separate? This is really ridiculous.
It is. And it's, you know, it's the government using the small businesses to do their bidding at the cost of potentially the businesses going under, right? The most divisive issue probably right now is vaccines. And they're asking businesses to basically alienate 50% of their customer base by forcing these sections. It's really, really scary in the ways in which they're using these businesses as proxies for that.
Yeah, well, if it isn't something like that, it would be, well, we're going to give you an incentive. We'll give you a case of beer, or we'll give you $100, or we'll give you free movie tickets, or something like that. They give an incentive to get you to vaccinate. And my local radio station, I ended up writing them a letter, was saying that if you come in and tell us that you're vaccinated, you're going to get an XYZ discount. And I'm thinking to myself, what about those of us that cannot get vaccinated because of underlying health conditions? So you're basically penalizing me because of something I cannot do, even if I wanted to. I mean, there's no logic to this.
It's unbelievable. It really is. I agree.
You know, I have to say, because the other day I walked into a doctor's office and it was something that was I had to have done. I needed this injection for pain. And I wear a face shield because I can't wear a mask. Of course, they go ballistic. And then they say, well, if you're not vaccinated, I don't know if I can treat you. Now, this is a doctor's office telling me, I don't know if I can treat you if you're not vaccinated. So I had to show her my medical alert bracelet. And I says, I can't get vaccinated. And only then did she relent. I'm thinking to myself, how many laws, lady, did you just break by trying to deny me service? I mean, it's the HIPAA Act by asking me, you know, my health condition when you're not authorized to do it. And it's the Americans with Disabilities Act if I have a disability that prevents me from doing it. And then no one tells the
the businesses out there what their legal liabilities will be if they violate either one of these acts.
Well, of course, and it's not as if any of the businesses have been given any immunity either. So, like I said, when they're asking us to do the bidding is that, you know, they're putting us in these situations, and then if we end up with a lawsuit, it's, oh, well, you know, figure it out.
Yeah, and that I found amazing. And I have to say, I went before my county council with the face mandate. And there's a video up on my page called Hurricane Annie, and my neighbors and friends and are getting a really kick out of it because I did exactly that to my county council. It says, you've got this resolution out there that you put out this mandate without warning local businesses what their legal liabilities and responsibilities are. I said, you're the ones that are irresponsible. You know, I had to take my husband to the hospital. He was getting pre-op. And before, my face shield was never a problem. But all of a sudden, this one day became a problem. And the security guard comes running after me, waving a face mask, going, you know, Mrs. Ubelis, you have to put this face mask on. I can't wear a face mask. You have to put the face mask. I says, I cannot. Why can't you? And that's when I said, I hit him with the HIPAA Act. And then he said, you've got to leave. Then I hit him with the Americans with Disabilities Act. I walked out of there so angry. I wrote a letter to the hospital CEO and the hospital chief surgeon. Within 24 hours, they are on the phone apologizing to me, telling me they started retraining the staff and redoing the rules. I walked in the other day, not a problem. Nope, don't worry. We don't even have to take your temperature. So there, it's arbitrary. There really is no rhyme or reason to it.
People like you.
You know something,
Andy? We need
more
people like you that'll jump in.
I posed that same question to somebody in the medical field about the HIPAA Act, and she was trying to tell me that that there was some kind of I don't know, they edited something else in there to waive the HIPAA Act in the case of COVID. And I'm like, well, where can I find this at? She couldn't tell me, but supposedly, you know, your rights in HIPAA are waived under COVID, and I found that hard to believe.
I have never heard of that, and not at all. Matter of fact, if I got a hospital CEO and the chief surgeon apologizing to me when I quoted the section of the HIPAA Act, they didn't come back to me and say it was waived. And this was only just a little over a month ago. It was not. So, Andrew, you know, this is the snowballs they try to make. This is how they twist and turn things to make us compliant. And this is the stuff you have to deal with as a business owner and keeping your employees employed.
100%.
Well,
and I was also thinking, I mean, unions are pretty big in California and most Democrat states. Are they kind of like responding to the misery their union members are experiencing? I never hear about the unions going up against some of these governors and this current administration about the harm that's being done to businesses and stuff that are, you know, under their union umbrella.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. Well, I think most of them are actually part of the larger businesses that have been given preference to remain open.
Well, if you have to go up against large chains, yeah, they will have that poll, and the unions will be in their pocket. They're actually more like lobbyists instead of union representatives. But are your employees all unionized too there, Andrew?
No, not anywhere.
Because we're here in South Carolina, we are a right-to-work state, which I love, so you don't have to worry about union interference. But I want to get over to something a little bit more lighter, if you don't mind, because even though, you know, we're dealing with the COVID pandemic, it's a serious subject, the way the government is bludgeoning us with it. Here in the South, we have these things called cicadas. Are you aware of them?
Oh, yeah, I'm an East Coast guy, so those were I remember them growing up.
Well, I had a laugh because when the news came out that the heart of the
infestation of cicadas is not going to be, because 17 years ago it was here in South Carolina and Georgia, but up in D.C. So I'm saying, oh, great, let's put the largest amount of noise that a bug can make right up their tushes. Put it in D.C. where it can do its best work. But, you know, people found something clever way to deal with it, and they decided that they're edible. Have you heard about that?
Well, that's just absurd. Yeah, I've been commenting on that. I would not eat them. I think that the idea that we should be eating them is an absurdity, and I think that it's just another move to try and get bugs in the headline. They want people to eat less meat.
Well, that's a whole big thing. I'm seeing these commercials for these nine meat meats, and you know, here they're trying to kill the meat industry. And it's the craziest thing I have ever heard. It's like we as humans can just subsist on chemicals and plants, and they want to do this thing about, you know, kill the greenhouse gases when we need CO2 to grow our crops. I mean, some of the stuff I hear them doing, it just makes my head spin thinking, are you aware that you're trying to kill off the human race? Maybe that's their point. They just intend to kill us off. So no meat, lower the CO2 so you have no vegetation. So what do we eat?
Yeah,
do you catch my drift?
It is. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Well, look, it was a real pleasure chatting. I've got to run back into the restaurants, but I appreciate the time, and I appreciate you giving me the platform.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. And I have a link to your website as well as the charity on my page here. So when people catch the podcast in the archives, they can click on it and give you a hand there.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Have a blessed day. Thank you, Andrew. Andrew Gruhl, check him out at Slapfish and check out the 86 Struggle, if I can talk straight here. Oh, boy. Anyway. All right, what do we got up next here?
I'll call our next guest.
Alex McFarland should be calling in a few minutes. So hopefully he will be calling in because Jackie said he's got the number and should be checking in anyway. Oh, man, this has been one of those days. I keep on hearing something drop in and out. I don't know if someone's got like a email or something popping up on them, but I keep on hearing something go in and out of my ear, but... We'll get through
it.
We'll get through this.
Is it a click or?
No, it's like one of those happy faces on Facebook pops up and lets you know. It's one
happy
of those
face.
Things. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. Man. I don't know. It's just weird things. Anyway, before we get Alex Cahill in, this is something I pulled up, and maybe Daryl, if you're still with us, you may want to jump in on this one. For over the last year and a half, China has been denying, or the media has been denying, China's had anything to do with this virus. You know, WHO said, no. It's just a freak of nature. The media, our government. But all of a sudden now, they're starting to agree, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, it did come out of China. That the origins really do come from this Wuhan lab. Gee. And all of a sudden, they're admitting to this. Now, why are they doing it at this time? And this is very, very interesting because up in the Daily Signal, Victor Davis Hanson has a very good article dealing with this. You know, suddenly without apologies, the journalists and experts conceded that the Wuhan lab may as well have been the likely genesis. And he says, well, why is the change? Well, one thing, Trump's no longer president. Trump was calling it the Chinese virus all along. But now Trump's not the president, so we don't have to bludgeon him with it. We can admit that it came out of China. Now, isn't that strange? So, okay, what's going to happen next? Anything deniability? What are we going to be doing with this? Well, lo and behold, this is coming from the Daily Wire. And apparently Hillary Clinton knew about the Wuhan lab and the bioweapons since 2009. And this is leaked out to the news that Clinton allegedly warned the State Department in a cable that was obtained by WikiLeaks that the work done at the Wuhan Institute of could lead to biological weapons. And Jack Prosebic of Human Events is reporting this. The cable obtained via WikiLeaks was sent from the State Department in June 2009 to all embassies in all member nations ahead of the Australia Group session in Paris in September. The Australian Group is an international export control forum organized to prevent the spread of technologies and research that could be used in chemical and biological weapons. Okay, so Hillary Clinton knew about this and warned everyone. And Clinton wrote in the memo, "We believe it's important to focus on emerging chemical and biological technologies, trends in the trade of CBW-related goods and threats. CBW stands for chemical and biological weapons." Addressing France, she stated, "The U.S. believes participants could benefit from hearing about your experiences assisting China in setting up a biosafety level 4 laboratory at the Wuhan Institute of Virology from the export controls and intangible technology transfer perspective. We are particularly interested to know how China plans to vet incoming foreign researchers from countries of biological weapons proliferation concern." So there was a concern about this Wuhan lab and creating a biological weapon. Now, tie that in with the fact that the Federal Health Institute gave funds to this Wuhan lab. Our own government gave funds. So does that mean that our own government under the Obama administration was helping the Wuhan lab create this virus? Did they know about it, and when did they know? Daryl, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, you want to chime in?
Well, I will say this much. I've always known it was from China, originated from China. The conservative broadcast that I listened to, they knew it was from China. It seemed like every conservative knew it originated in China, and because our president also was saying that was from China. I mean, after all, he's the head of our nation, and he has an intelligence briefing just about every day, so you would think he would know. So I never had any doubt that it originated in China. Now, the left will deflect that because I think they're so caught up in China in the business sense, and they have been co-opted by the Chinese, and they're trying to protect their own interests and involvement with the Chinese, just like Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. So I see a lot of that going on, you know, the denials because of the fact that these guys behind closed doors are in bed with the Chinese in so many ways. But it's coming out. You can't keep the truth hidden for so long. And you're right, they didn't want to say it because Trump was in office, and they didn't want to affirm anything Trump said or did. That's my spin.
Well, thank you, Curtis. And, you know, I saw also a report that someone, I think it might have been the Daily Signal or one of those, reprinting a research done by the CDC looking into vaccines for COVID-19. It was dated 2018. Think about that, 2018, a full year before I learned about the outbreak, before it was recognized. I learned about the outbreak, it was either the end of September or October, through friends of mine as missionaries in the Wuhan province. It finally came, slightly started to leak into the news in end of November, December, and finally recognized officially in January of 2020. So you're talking about almost a year and a half before it was a officially recognized by any government that they were already looking for vaccines. Now, that I find very interesting, which then begs to differ. These laboratories that developed these vaccines, what were they holding back from the Trump administration? And when Trump pulled the rabbit out of the hat, were they already halfway there? And all they said, oh, yeah, we'll do the miracle, and then you can take, you know, the clap on the back. So, you know, I'm just wondering who knew what and when and where. So, I don't know.
You never know. Like,
well,
I said,
Curtis,
in the end, the truth will come out.
Yeah.
You want me to call our next caller?
Yeah, just remember to put both of you in the little green room.
All righty.
All right, Curtis is going to be calling in our next guest. And I've got lots of good little goodies here, but I think we may have lost Daryl here, or that, or he fell asleep. Anyway, I'm looking for some of the stuff I wanted to talk about, and I've got a whole big thick stack, so bear with me, people, because there's some of the stuff I wanted to put aside to talk with Hans von Spakovsky when he finally calls in at the end of the show. But here, this is good news. Our Supreme Court finally is starting to come around, and they're starting to get their act together. A recent ruling came out. It was a 8-1 boards, you know, often challenge a student's constitutional right to free speech. Well, there was this young girl that was criticizing the school district. She did it off, not during school hours, not on school property, not using school property, but she just, you know, got onto her social network, and she used some profanity to insult her school after she was cut from a cheerleading team. She made the post off the school grounds, and the Supreme Court, when they found out, when the case went before them, they had suspended the girl and penalized her for her language that she did off campus. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. When the child is on your property and under your care, yes, you can restrict. But once she's off the property, on her own time, on her own social network, whatever, she has the God-given right of free speech. So they got it right. So, you know, the Supreme Court said, you know, that a Pennsylvania high school violated the First Amendment rights of a cheerleader by punishing her for using vulgar language that criticized the school on social media. The courts must be more skeptical of the school's efforts to regulate off-campus speech. For doing so may mean the student may not engage in that kind of speech at all. So finally, the Supreme Court is starting to get some of these things right. And let's welcome back onto the show, as I get all my papers shuffled around here, Alex McFarland. Good afternoon, Alex. How are you today?
Well, I am blessed. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me again.
Oh, it's always fun to talk to you. It is always fun. One of the things that came to mind, which made me think of you, is the election of Ed Litton to the Southern Baptist as the new president there. And it brought me back to the years of court cases that my own church went through when it split from the Episcopal Church, and ours being the conservative side, the Episcopals being more liberal. We wanted to be more biblical, and they wanted to be more social woke. But this is now happening in the Southern Baptist Church. Haven't they learned anything?
Oh, my goodness.
This is really scary.
Well, it really is. I was reading. And by the way, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your stand for the Word of God. And, you know, before I came on, I was listening. I dialed in, and my wife and I are driving, and I listened to your show for the last 20 or 30 minutes, and maybe we'll circle back to HIPAA. But, look, a sure way to kill a denomination is to veer left. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church USA. My family had been in the Presbyterian this one particular North Carolina Presbyterian church for 200 years, literally, family members. And my dad was an elder and was, you know, very biblical and very conservative. And over a 25-year period, we watched the Presbyterian Church USA just cannibalize itself. And the more they dwindled, the farther left they went. It was almost like this pathological mindset, like, we're not liberal enough, let's go more liberal. When I was in college, I, through a Bible study, became a Christian through a Baptist church. And I got into the Baptist church, and I was one to the Lord through a Baptist church, and later felt the call to preach. And so, believe me, I've got a lot of experience and knowledge with how the Southern Baptists work. And I will say this, the way to health is get back to the Word of God and the Great Commission. The way to dry up and die is to follow what the United Methodist, the American, you know, the Episcopal and the PCUSA. And that's why I have a big announcement here in a minute, but I'm with you. The sure way to irrelevance and non-existence is to turn left.
You know, I have to say that we did win the court case eventually. There's still going to be a final ruling, but we expect it to go our way because of the way the judge was asking certain questions before he made his final decision. So, you know, our church is not going to be changed into a mosque like that Episcopal bishop promised us. But we do have to fight back because I've spoken about this before. It's the Jezebel spirit working on dividing us and destroying the church. And it,
yes.
And you have to be able to see it, look at it, and recognize it. But, you know, give us your big announcement.
Well, within the SBC, it's in Religious Liberty Commission, and that's really the public policy think tank within the Baptists. And whenever there are things in the news that impinge on religion and culture, the ERLC will, you know, set out like a position paper, and ostensibly it's to be the biblical position. Now, I know a little bit about this because 20 years ago, for 4 years, almost 5 years, I was working for the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptists, and I was director of apologetics, and I traveled all over the country. And after I left there and went to work for James Dobson, the apologetics department really got folded into the ERLC. Now, after I left, there was a gentleman named Richard Land, very conservative, frankly, brilliant guy, and he led the ERLC till he retired. Well, for the last 8 years, the ERLC has been the subject of lots of discussion among Southern Baptist pastors because they were anti-Trump. I mean, it was like all of the press releases of the ERLC were like talking points straight off the desk of AOC. Open borders, never Trump. I mean, anti-Israel, it was crazy. Now hang with me, folks, because this is going somewhere. Given, let me say this, the 16 to 20 million Southern Baptist laity and the thousands of Southern Baptist churches that support with their pocketbook, and by and large, they're very conservative, very biblical. Look, when their theological voice was crying leftist talking point, I mean, they did all they needed to do, and they stopped giving. So the guy that was leading it, I wish him no ill, but he, just before their convention this month, he resigned and went to work for the increasingly left-leaning Christianity Today. And I think that was a wise decision because had he stayed through the conference in June, he wouldn't have had a job. All right. That being said, I make an offer to the Southern Baptist Convention. And I am entirely serious in what I'm about to say. I don't think there's a snowflake's chance that this is going to happen to the Southern Baptist at 21 years old. I was discipled. I heard the call to ministry. I found my wife in a Southern Baptist church, got married. I was a Southern Baptist youth pastor for 11 years. I've preached in 2,300 churches total, about 50% of which were Southern Baptist. I've done national and international mission work for the Southern Baptist. And I've written 18 books. And by the way, if anyone's listening and you want to know, the closest one of my books that would be like an encyclical from the ERLC would be my book, 10 Issues That Divide Christians. I talk about social justice. I talk about immigration. I talk about all the relevant issues. And then my more recent book, The Assault on America, How to Defend Our Nation Before It's Too Late, does the same. Now, all of that being said, I've got the knowledge of the Southern Baptist machine. I've got the trust of roughly 1,000 Southern Baptist pastors, and definitely got the academic and theological street cred. So, Baptists, here's my offer. I will lead the ERLC, and it will not cost you one penny. I offer myself pro bono. I want to serve the denomination that brought me to Christ. I've got a publicist. We're on 251 radio stations. I can virtually guarantee that your giving will dramatically go up, because what I'm going to do, if by some miracle of God, somebody from the Baptist machine calls me and says, okay, kiddo, you're willing to do this for free, no six-figure salary like the previous guy, won't cost him a penny, seriously. We will claim the good news to this nation. We will equip the saints to think biblically. We will get this denomination back on solid scriptural ground. And if after 1 year they don't like what we're doing with ERLC, no harm, no foul. But isn't that a fair offer to help prevent this denomination from going left?
Yeah. If you're willing to give it without a penny and from your heart for the cause of our Lord, yes. I don't see why not.
Exactly. And listen, I've managed the staff of the biggest staff I ever managed, I managed a staff of about 40 people with a I did a $7 million capital campaign, and I had about a $3 million a year budget I've managed. So the administrative side of things is not heavy lifting. I mean, I'm very serious. I was on an interview yesterday, and I said this, and they were saying, you know, oh, God forbid they put another woke person in the ERLC. And I said, well, I'll do it. Goodness, I've sent hundreds of journal articles. I've been on Fox and CNN. I know the game. It's not a game. I mean, but what we have to do, whoever chairs the ERLC for the Baptist should not only be kind of the theological conscience of the denomination, with an eye toward what's going on in the culture, but it should be somebody to unify the church, not be divisive, not try to straighten out the parishioners. This is one thing that the left, they're always so condescending. They want to straighten out the people that pay their paycheck. You know, it's like, you conservatives, you patriotic people, you faith and values, you're so myopic and ignorant and so sheltered, but yet we need your money to help wake you. And so anyway, yeah, I'm going to actually over the weekend, I'm speaking all weekend, but by Monday I will post on my Facebook page, Rev. Alex McFarland, I'm going to post a position paper and a plan for what the ERLC could do. Now, I don't have one shred of belief that they'll call me on this, because the executive committee of the SBC, I'm not sure they realize what dire straits they're in, really. But it's time for a revival, Baptists, and let's unify together. Let's recommit ourselves not to progressive Christianity, but real biblical Christianity. And let's try to denomination that we once were, the people of the book and the people of the Great Commission.
And I'm going to be saying some prayers, and I think a lot of listeners out there are going to be saying the same thing. So you may be getting a lot of prayers, and it may come true. And I got to tell you something. My sister sent me a text before I came on air. My brother-in-law, her husband, happens to be a Baptist minister. They just moved south. And right now, the church that he has joined is putting him in charge of teaching a course on apologetics.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's right up there out that alley with you. So maybe one day the two of you will get to meet, because whenever my husband has a question or he needs to talk about something, it's my brother-in-law, he calls, and then, you know, there's my husband with the Bible and going, can you explain this to me?
Yeah. Well, it would be my great honor to meet him.
Yeah. They're now in Georgia. They fled New York. They fled New York. And,
oh, wow. So, they're refugees from New York.
Yeah, they got here just before the pandemic hit. And as he said, the Lord was driving them to the destination. And I think the final seal on the deal was that the house they were looking to purchase was, the name of the street is Annie's Way.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, it's just the providence of the Lord that they moved when they did.
Yes, it is. I mean, they got the house at the right price, because had they waited any longer, it would have probably been doubled because the cost of construction and everything. They really were guided. They really were guided. You know,
amen.
We're seeing so much going on with this new woke society, and people don't understand. You can still be truly a biblical Christian. Fine, there is a woke society, but it doesn't mean that I need to let it into my church, my faith, or my home. What you do behind your doors, or if you find yourself a Unitarian church that'll accept you for whatever it was, go for it. You know, if you ask me my opinion, I'll give it honestly. But I also will give it with love. But that's what instead of accepting us for who we are, they demand we accept them, but yet they will reject us.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, that's the disingenuous nature of liberalism. And really, that's talking out of both sides of their mouth. I'll never forget, in my hometown paper of Greensboro, North Carolina, there was a female Unitarian minister. We had done a big conference, and one of the things that we've been very privileged to do is a conference all over the country called Truth for a New Generation. And we've got one coming up October 15 through 17 in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. By the way, and we've got great speakers like Bishop E.W. Jackson and Frank Turek and Sandy Rios and many, many great speakers. And my website is just my name, alexmcfarland.com. But we've done major citywide events in hundreds of American cities, literally. But we did one in Greensboro. One event we did in Greensboro had 8,000 youth. And then we did one that had 5,000 people. Well, a Unitarian minister, because we'd brought in all these speakers like Josh McDowell and Chuck Colson, great speakers. Well, this Unitarian minister wrote an article that, you know, was pretty much refuting our conference. You know, we were there telling kids that you have to be born again, and we were telling kids that marriage is between a man and a woman. And this Unitarian minister wrote this article and said that, you know, the new Christianity must be tolerant. You know, we can't be exclusive. We have to be tolerant. And she said in the article, she said, the one thing, though, that I will not tolerate is that old blood and guts religion, like there's power in the blood. And what can wash away my sin? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. And she said, that is the one thing I will not tolerate. in this article. And I was thinking, well, Hebrews 9:27, you know, says that without the shedding of blood, I'm sorry, Hebrews 9:22, without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sin, the blood of Jesus to wash our sin away. So if you take away Christ's sacrifice on Calvary's cross, there, we have no hope of salvation. But the other thing is, this is what I would say to all the progressives, selective tolerance is intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the left prides itself on their tolerance, but the thing they don't tolerate are people that comes to truth. We believe in absolute truth. And so for all of their self-congratulatory posture, selective tolerance is intolerance.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, when I have government, you know, telling me that my church must allow same sex into the bathroom because the transgender may say that he is a she and she is a he or whatever, you know, no, you have to allow them to use the bathroom. And meanwhile, we're saying, no, God made man and God made woman. So we have separate bathrooms, you know. But no. You
right.
can't. That's intolerant. However, you're being intolerant of my faith. And yet it's our constitutional right that government cannot prohibit the free expression thereof. So, you know, they have been attacking faith nonstop.
Well, you know, 20 years ago I was working with James Dobson, a brilliant man, PhD. He was head of for UCLA Medical School, he was head of clinical psychology, pediatric clinical psychology, brilliant, accomplished academic, and a great man of God, James Dobson. 20 years ago, Dobson said, we were in a meeting. He said, well, the gay LGBTQ trans agenda is about hindering the proclamation of the gospel. And at the time, I somewhat disagreed with him. I thought, no, they're just wanting validation. And he said, you watch. Abandoning natural law, abandoning basic biology, letting emotions trump science, and giving, because this is the key, giving a behavior the same status as an ethnicity. You know, I've met many former homosexuals. Just this week, I interviewed a couple of former transgenders. But you'll never meet a former Caucasian or a former Hispanic. I mean, really. And Dobson, 20 years ago, said all of this legitimization of deviant behavior will ultimately, unless God intervenes, cause us to be committing a crime if we call sinners to repentance. Now, in 1993, President Clinton signed a bill that was championed by Chuck Schumer, and it was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And Bill Clinton, and I quote this in some of my talks on law and government, in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, and again, folks, get your mind around this, championed, that bill was pushed through by Chuck Schumer, a Democrat who I believe is a Catholic, as he signed it, and I'm glad he did, but he said, we can never be too vigilant in protecting the right to free religious expression. And he said, we can never, I mean never, be too vigilant in this. All right. The Equality Act that has been voted on, I think, by the Senate, but not by the House right now.
Right.
The Equality Act, also championed by Chuck Schumer, specifically says that when it comes to hiring public accommodations, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 93 cannot be used to exempt churches or faith organizations from acknowledging gay and transgender people.
You know, I had a debate with my state senator because he was trying to push it through here on the state level. And I had a just had a brain fart. Phil Schlafly, I had the pleasure of interviewing her just before she passed away. And one of the things we did discuss was the Equality Act of, I believe it was 1972, which they resurrected and then have reworded and shoved up down everyone's throat. So he and I had a bit of a lengthy text debate and email debate. And I tried to explain to him that today the word sex is not the same as gender. And so now it is an excuse to let anything go. And then what about this religious free? And I said, I pointed out the fact that Chuck Schumer, and I have a different, I accidentally used the different term in front of my mother and she cracked up. She's a little Italian Roman Catholic. It was not a, it was not a polite word.
Live radio.
Anyway, he understood where I was coming from. As it is worded, you know, instead of saying biological gender, no, they use the word sex. So I said, that means that you can then legalize pedophilia, necrophilia, or any other philia out there, however you feel about it. But, you know,
bestiality.
People, so they don't understand the ramifications. They're hearing the words of people in the public and the media trying to explain it to them without getting into the grassroots. Once you get into the grassroots, then you see the true evil behind these bills.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, there's so much to say, and I know time fleets away, and I'm so grateful for you being the voice that you are. But our country, I'm going to say this, the most important topic that no one is talking about is our moral foundation, i.e. natural law. Earlier in the week, I was on a show that was dealing with abortion. And right away, somebody on the comment thing online said, keep your religion out of this. Let me say this. Morality and religion are two different things. The non-establishment clause of the First Amendment means the government is not going to show preferential treatment to any specific religion. I get that. But what is so dangerous, and it really imperils our Constitution right now, is that the non-establishment clause regarding religion, the left has parlayed into the abolition of all moral boundaries. Now,
yep.
I want to say to the gays, atheists, transgender, you don't want to be a Christian? Fine, don't be a Christian. You don't want to be heterosexual? Fine, sleep with whatever will crawl in bed with you. But what we can't let any group do is lure us away from what Jefferson called self-evident truth. Listen, the gays and transgender can fornicate till their dying day, but we can't go against 6,000 years of human history and make male and female fluid because, listen, if we don't have this belief in moral truth, it's natural law. Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Jefferson, John Locke, the founders wrote about this. Without moral boundaries, we cannot have the rule of law or what America has been for 240 years. And basically, where we are, I'll say this and I'm done, we're basically burning our house down to make deviant people feel good about something that deep inside they know is wrong anyway.
Well, Alex, I want to thank you for joining us. There's a link to your webpage on mine, alexmcfarland.com. And when they go there, they can click on your podcast, I Hear Ya. The I Hear Ya dot show, correct?
Wow. Yes. And go to my Facebook page, if you would, Rev, R-E-V, Rev Alex McFarland, and I'll post my plan for the ERLC if by some miracle they want to sit down and talk with me.
Absolutely. I'll make sure my brother-in-law gets it. God bless you, Alex, for the hard work you do. Thank you.
Bless you, my friend.
All right. Alex McFarland, check him out at alexmcfarland.com. And we have a new guest, and I want to welcome her aboard. She's here at the Nut Farm with the rest of us, Andy Berger. Good afternoon, Andy. How are you doing today?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. Thank you.
I got to get my notes, everything switched around, because whenever I talk to Alex, I just changed his gender. Alex, I always have a hard time. Holy cow. Now, you have a nonprofit organization that you formed with your husband over in Oregon called Beulah's Place. It's a rescue at risk for homeless youth. And, you know, tell us how you came about to establish this.
Absolutely. In 2008, we established Beulah's Place because we saw a great need for teens that seemed to be lost. They were on the streets. In November of that year, we were serving meals to homeless families, and a couple of young gals came in, barely 17 or 18, and they had newborn babies, you know, in their arms, and found out they were living in their cars because there was no place to go. And so my husband and I at that time, we thought, we have to do something. What can we do? Well, what if we rent a warehouse and we feed the kids? Well, that's great, but then what happens? You know, and what if we put in beds? How long could they stay? So, you know, out of that, we established Beulah's Place, where we would get to the root of the issue, why the kids were on the streets. Many of them were running from something far worse than living on the street, which I understand because I have a personal history with having been trafficked long before that term came into play by, you know, family members. And so Beulah's Place was designed to help these at-risk homeless teens get off the streets, finish high school, get jobs, and reintegrate into community the way we believe God designed them to be.
Now, where did the name come from?
Beulah was my husband's mom's name. I didn't meet her. She passed about a year before we met. She was just this wonderful woman who raised three boys with her husband. And basically, it was one way to honor her. Everyone who knew her said she was, you know, just this great lady who would, you know, feed the neighborhood or do whatever on a potato, you know, just a really generous woman. And then secondly, in the old biblical times, there's a place called Beulah Land, which is between heaven and earth, and our kids are between childhood and adulthood. But sometimes legally they're an adult, even though they're still very childlike and they're just trying to survive. And then finally, a rabbi friend of ours, he said, well, you know, it's a pure Hebrew word, Andy, and it means to bring together, to join. And I thought, what a great, great picture. We're trying to bring them back to community, join them back to the life they deserve to have.
Wow. That is such a wonderful, wonderful story. You know, you, like you said, you have a history, and you speak out against this human trafficking. And we have this border crisis that our administration just does not really want to recognize. And today is obvious with, I call her Queen Kamala Mella, going to El Paso, Texas, instead of going all the way down to the actual border. Even though El Paso does have its problems, you know, seeing it hands-on at the border would actually help the administration know what the problem is. But no. That's not the picture they want the media to project. But these children are just being brought over and dumped. And we've seen, and it breaks my heart. And what does our government do? They then dump them into these warehouses, whatever else would you call them, and then put them on buses and send them through the rest of the United States with no guidance, no guardians, and dumping them in cities and towns that don't even know that they're coming. And these children have no one there to protect them. Some of them have already been abused, and now they face further abuse and life on the street.
It is definitely a horrific situation. It was bad before the border crisis, but now it's exponentially horrific because just think in terms of sheer numbers for listeners. Okay, $160 billion plus dollars globally for human trafficking. $99 billion of that is sexual trafficking, sex trafficking. So now in the U.S., you know, we're at about $40 billion, and we're going to fast overtake the drug trade as the number one illegal activity in the U.S., which I don't think is anything to be proud of. But to your point on the border, we know that the cartels and other predators are selling these children, and they don't care what you do with them. But the going rate a month ago was $3,200. You can buy a kid and do whatever you want with that young child. Like you said, also, they're being transported to different parts of the country. Imagine if you don't know English or the language, if you don't have the skills, if you have no education or training, how are you going to survive? This is exactly what predators and pedophiles want because, oh, hey, we'll pay you cash. We'll feed you. You know, we'll give you a bed if you do this. And so it's just the thousands and thousands and thousands more we have to deal with now is really overwhelming and completely unnecessary.
You know, I have a friend of mine I was speaking to last night. He's the former chief of police, and his son is a border officer. And he got yanked off of close to the Canadian border and brought down to what's going on in Texas. And the stories that he was telling us last night about what is going on is horrific, absolutely horrific. You know, the border officers are not allowed to fingerprint or photograph or anything. You just process them, but you can't use the word process, and then send them on their way. And these kids... we find foster parents, and this was coming out of Portland. I'm sure they're doing it in other states as well. Foster parents were told, we're taking your American-born children that are foster children out of your home, putting them back into the system, and those four kids you're watching, no, we're going to give you 20 of these little minors coming across the border. Now you're going to be foster parents to these 20 kids. It doesn't matter. You only have two bedrooms. You are now foster parents. Dumping these kids anywhere and everywhere, especially on foster families that are ill-equipped to even handle them.
The systems were taxed before all of this broke loose, and you're right. And, you know, here's the thing. Human trafficking isn't new. It's been going on for generations and generations, but it's more apparent. You have the Epstein and the Maxwells, and there's been some, you know, national news about things like this, but there's familial trafficking, which is what I came out of, you know, where families do that. And I am sure there are families across the border. I have counterparts there that are trying to rescue as many kids as they can that have just been abandoned. But, you know, there are families who probably believe they're trying to send their child to a better life. They pay somebody that they don't even know, you know, to hopefully take them over. And the truth is, they're not going to be taken care of the way some of those parents may think. But at the end of the day, you're right. We have all of these children, and who is helping them? Who is putting a pinch in that pipeline that just allows all of these poor kids to end up in a country that should have compassion, that should love them, that should be able to, you know, manage things, but it's not. It's not compassionate when you throw them into warehouses or old military places or stadiums. How is that better? You know, and who's watching them? Who's vetting them? Do they have bathrooms? Are they eating? Right? All those questions. And yet we don't really, you know, not all of us have the photos and the videos to see what's going on down there. And so it is tragic. You know, human trafficking, Annie, in my perspective, is 21st century slavery. Victims cannot escape. They're literally imprisoned, or they're drugged to the point that, you know, they're sold 20, 25 times a day. And when they're of no use, they usually die. Maybe one in 100 will escape. But here in the U.S., every 40 seconds, a child is abducted. Not running away. They're abducted. They're taken. And I just believe as a country, we have to unite on this issue, which is a human issue, a human rights issue. It's not political. It's not religious. It is human. And it is a crime against humanity to allow this to continue, in my opinion.
You know, there's so many aspects to this that is so heartbreaking. But then you throw in access children have to social networks and the same access that predators have to that social network. So it's not just a matter of these kids coming over the border or kids being abducted, but kids being lured also into human trafficking.
Yes. Absolutely. Who's vetting what is on the internet? You know, the parents are busy. Everyone's been locked down. There's a huge increase in virtual this, virtual that. And yet some of the kids, the gaming, things that go on, it may open up and look like an innocent game. But we have folks that are with Voices Against Trafficking, one of my organizations, and they are very savvy about they go in and they play the game a little bit only to find out that it opens up into something more insidious, you know, more sinister. And so these kids don't know what they're getting into till they're actually in the middle of the game. And so a parent that might casually say, oh, that looks like it's a good game, honey, it's okay, they don't really know that. And even so in Oregon, you know, simple things like an ad for, hey, we'll hire teens, right, 15, 16, 17-year-olds to mow lawns or to babysit or you know, to do something. We'll pick you up. You don't have to have a car. We'll pick you up, right? Well, who's checking on the person that's picking up your kid? Who's checking on the college students? You know, the three major universities have had sex scandals, you know, USC and Pennsylvania, Michigan, all of those things. Who is checking on the people that are in charge of your child or working with your child, coaching your child, schooling your child, and trying to get your child to take a job that doesn't really exist?
Or kids being shamed. You know, everyone else does this, so why aren't you? That's another huge thing.
Exactly. Yeah, peer pressure. I remember that. I don't know about you, but there was a lot, you know, in my day and age, 60 years ago, but the peer pressure, absolutely. Well, it's just, you know, it's just the top you have to take off, you know, or whatever it may be. And look at the movies like Cuties that came out, that Netflix thought was okay to sexualize children in a movie, put that out there, so that every predator, every pedophile, anyone who was even thinking about being one, you know, could see 8, 10, 12-year-olds gyrating and doing all of this stuff under the guise of, oh, it's dance, you know? We have desensitized ourselves to the value and the preciousness, for lack of a better word, of a young child being a young child.
Part is when they get videotaped and it comes back to haunt them. And
absolutely,
sometimes they don't even know.
Never.
Yeah.
Exactly. They'll never outlive that.
No. And this then leads into having all this trauma on them, having PTSD.
Yes, absolutely. The one thing that most people don't see, and I will tell you that even though, so I was sex trafficked by family, immediate family and some extended family members from 6 months to 17 years old back in the early 60s and 70s. I was 5 the first time I tried to take my life and 17 the last time my birth mother tried to kill me. And so you just take that portion of childhood, teenagehood, and all the things that go with, you know, the changes and what you have going on. But here I am, you know, just shy of 60, and I am just now acknowledging, you know what? I do have some PTSD issues. I've been to counseling. I've been to therapy. I have a wonderful marriage. And, you know, we just don't realize that sometimes when we're not ourselves, it's not depression. It's not hormones. It could be from trauma, whether that trauma was a divorce or the death of someone you love or a horrific movie. But, you know, in cases of victims of sexual violations or sex trafficking or physical abuse, mental and emotional, there will always be triggers, and it's how you deal with them that matters. And right now, with the pandemic, people are traumatized by, how am I going to eat? How am I going to get back to work? How am I going to live? How am I going to get my kids to school? You know, they've got all of this panic, and it's been going on far too long. And when you lock everyone up, you also lock predators up.
And then they're inside that house with that child.
Yep,
and
absolutely.
There's no getting away for that child. So, you know, this is something that not very many people want to talk about because it's uncomfortable. But it has to be talked about because these children are our future. They were us.
Absolutely.
Now, they are going to be us. And if we don't take care of this next generation coming up, this world's going to be in trouble. Because unfortunately, sometimes this becomes a cycle through life. If a child is abused, they are possibly prone to become an abuser later on, unless they're taken care of properly and helped.
Absolutely. And if we just took one day at a time, if we just talked to each other, you know, kept lines of communication open. One of the things people ask, well, you know, what can we do or how can I keep my kids safe? Well, you know, you can't protect a child 24/7. But what you can do is keep the communication lines open or learn how to communicate or have a system that says, look, no matter what happens in your life, this is your safe place. Or you can tell me anything. And even if it's something that I'm not happy about, I want you to feel safe to talk to me so I can, you know, protect you or, you know, whatever. Or to have a buddy system or a family word. You know, maybe your family word is you know, pineapple. And if you text that to mom, she knows you're in trouble or whatever it is. And I'm not making light of it. I'm just trying to make it more palatable that, you know, if you allow your children to socialize and things like that, it's also on the guardian, the parent, whoever is in charge of that child, to watch out for them, to take care of them. And there's also an increase because of the lockdowns and the stress of self-medication, right? Big shocker. So now you have, I just rescued two girls about 2 months ago, well, almost 2 months ago. Both of them, you know, drug addicted. One parent was drug addicted, the other parent non-existent, and there were, you know, lots of men or women in and out of, you know, the living areas. And so the kids were malnutritioned. They had no dental. They had no vision care. They're 14, right? So what are you going to do with that? What's a young teen supposed to do when they don't have resources, a place to go? You know, which was another reason for Beulah's Place. And then, you know, we expanded into Voices Against Trafficking because we need more voices. We need everyone listening today to be part of the solution.
You know, you do such wonderful, marvelous work. We have to get this network to go nationwide so that, you know, every kid can be helped. And the worst part is that, you know, not only are these forced to kids that are Americans being dumped back into the system to accommodate these illegal aliens coming in that should not have ever been separated from their parents, but we are now taking the homeless, which include children, out of the shelters to allow the illegal aliens to have some place to go. So we're throwing the homeless with their children or children that are homeless from the shelter back onto the street. So they're only compounding the problem.
And re-traumatizing everyone involved, and they're just shifting from, it's kind of like if you don't deal with your own problems and you buy a new house or a new relationship or whatever it is, you're taking those same problems with you, just different territory, just a new yard, you know, or a new honeymoon period with something or somebody. So now we're doing that to these children, and that is what is so critically wrong and why there isn't an outrage. Where are the civil liberties people? Why aren't they rising up saying, hey, all children need to be protected and taken care of? You can't just pick and choose. You can't make them political tools because they're human beings. And they should be their rights should count just as much as yours and mine and everyone listening today. Why don't those rights count for them?
You know, I've asked this a long, long time ago when I first started doing the show and hearing about these parents bringing the children across the border illegally. I says, why aren't these parents then being prosecuted for child abuse, making them trek that long journey across the hot desert, being trafficked? You know, why isn't there, you know, child abuse charges against these the good Lord, I just had a brain fart here. The people that they paid, coyotes, see?
Right.
Part. Why aren't they being caught and prosecuted? You know, but this administration just doesn't want to touch the issue. And I don't even know what the answer to that would be. How do we get the public to know? How do we get the public to react?
Well, one of the things that we're doing, you know, our small part is every quarter we hold a virtual forum right now. We used to do it on Capitol Hill in D.C., but we're doing it virtually. It's free. It's over Facebook and YouTube live streaming. And actually, next Wednesday, June 30th, from 2 p.m. Eastern Time to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We are bringing a lot of speakers, a couple members of Congress who are proactive in trying to make changes. We have different people that have had survival stories. We have experts in different industries like social media and gaming. We also have people that will help, you know, shed some light in different parts of our country, as well as a couple of folks that are right there on the border from law enforcement and from Mexico, all trying to resolve, all trying to find solutions and put them together. So it's our way of, one, trying to educate people that may not understand, you know, how big this is, what happens, you know, who's doing anything about it, and then also to create greater awareness so people will want to ask and say, what can I do? You know, to see something, say something, that's great, but we need more right now because too many kids are being violated, sold, and even dying as a result of this. I can't control, you know, the administration, but what I can do as a citizen and as a human being is speak not only my story, but the hope that we have that if we do intercede, we have 7 of the kids that we've rescued in college, graduating college. We have several others who started families. We have 200 that would have been dead, you know, otherwise finishing high school and wanting to do other things. So if we take the first step and say, okay, we do have a problem, you know, who can we trust to help with it? Okay, now let's go to the next step. And there are a lot of programs we could institute in schools if the schools would allow us that are free that would help peer-to-peer vetting. You know, they would vet themselves out for homelessness, hunger, abuse, trafficking, and it would start as young as 5 years old. But trying to get anyone to acknowledge that, you know, all I can say is someone always knows when there is a child being abused. And here's the thing. Someone's always covering for that, the higher up the social status, social rank, power ladder there is. And that's a hard thing to break. But we can start with one kid today and then 10 kids and then 100 and then 1,000, and we can keep working our way towards a better protection of their rights.
Is there anywhere people can go to get this information to put before, say, their school board or school superintendent or for their county council, city council, to start the ball rolling in their community?
Well, I am working on that currently. After our forum on Wednesday, I am going to be hopefully connected with the gal in Australia who designed the SEMPI program, S-E-M-P-I, and it has worked very well in 20 countries. It's not in our country or not fully functioning in our country yet, but it's a very simple program. And so I was interviewed by her a couple years ago, and I'm absolutely passionate about bringing it to the states if it's not already here, but getting it to communities that want it, that are willing to do the work, because all it takes is one or two people to do the training. And so if I can get that coordinated, that's what I think would, one, be a good start, because we'd get it into the schools, the kindergartens up.
Wow. You know, I would love to have something like that here that I can present. I mean, because I still run a tea party and we still have monthly meetings, and to get someone in to start talking about this, to start the ball rolling in the community.
Sure.
And then bringing it to the school superintendent, who I do know, and he's a good guy. So I'm sending it over to him as well as to my members in council as well as the school board. But I'm thinking also going not just to schools, but the churches.
Absolutely. We're trying to rally the churches. In fact, we're about to kind of launch a special invitation to national churches and all over the country, starting with, you know, female leaders, and pastors are often overwhelmed. Priests are overwhelmed. Everybody's overwhelmed. But we want to rally the women and rally the churches in general to act, not just, you know, do a couple of videos or program awareness things, but to really get involved. And so that'll be rolling out hopefully in the next month or two as well. So we have lots coming down the pike that we would love to share with you and continue to educate communities, because my heart's desire is if you know, then you will want to act at some point, because it could be your niece or nephew or sister or child that, you know, is abducted or is affected by this. There will be a family that you know at some point that will be affected because it's that massive right now. And, you know, Arizona just passed a bill. Congresswoman Debbie Lesko sent me a video that we're going to show during our forum. And they passed a bill, first state in the union, that if you violate, if you're a sexual predator or a sex trafficker and you're caught, you will have life imprisonment with no possibility of parole, no early release, no special privileges. You will be locked down for life until you die. That's
can
a
you
start.
Send a copy of that? Can you send me a copy of that? I'd really appreciate
yes.
of the actual legislation, because if anything, I know exactly who to hand that to. And she was at our GOP meeting last night. She's someone that I've known for 20 years, and she's now my state representative. And she actually runs a school. And if anyone will get that, and she's chairing a couple of committees now. So, yeah, if anyone could write the legislation for here in South Carolina, she would. I really appreciate that.
That would be awesome. You know, the more states we get on board, the more people that really do just a piece, you know, bite a piece of the elephant off, help us make your community aware. And here's the thing, even in my own county, Annie, I can't tell you, the district attorney publicly stated multiple times he doesn't believe we have human trafficking because he hasn't prosecuted it. And then, you know, the former speaker of the Oregon House was indicted for sex trafficking. So when our own leadership doesn't care or isn't concerned, we have to recall them, get them, vote them out of office, do whatever it takes. But everyone needs to find out, hey, you know, mayor, hey, state representative, hey, state senator, where are you on this? And why am I not hearing about what you're doing to end human trafficking and put 21st century slavery in this state or this town or this community to bed? So we need to really enforce accountability. But if we don't care or we're too traumatized to act, then we're going to lose we're going to have more victims.
Yeah, and it becomes the dirty little secret in the family. And it's easier
yes.
to hide it and turn your back to it. No, daddy could not possibly do that. No, your brother possibly could not do that to you. And when it's a denial, and then that denial turns into, you know, being a partner in the situation, which you went through, where your mom was just as culpable as the person that was doing this to you. And it's the dirty little secret that stays behind the door. No, no, you can't tell anyone about Uncle Al out there. But, you know,
exactly.
We have to open the doors, open the window, get the fresh air back out, you know, sanitize this, and let's just put an end to it. I don't think there'll ever be end, but let's start stemming it. And the worst part is the trauma that you have gone through, the traumas that others have gone through, the PTSD, I mean, it could lead, as I said, you know, further abuse to another child down the road, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, suicide. Unless there's someone like you that recognizes, hey, you had a problem, this just wasn't right, and you found help and you found salvation.
Absolutely. And a lot of the after effects, like you just said, depression, anxiety disorders, you know, substance abuse, shame and guilt will drive people to do things they wouldn't normally do. I mean, I felt like yesterday's garbage. If God had not interceded in my life, you know, that would have been it. Victims feel alienated. You can't talk about this at Sunday dinner or, you know, as a 10-year-old to another classmate. You know, you just don't. Suicidal ideation, definitely the inability to trust. I mean, who can you trust when people that are supposed to love you hurt you? My birth mother was the ringleader, okay? You know, and then it was just downhill from there. And so you're trapped when you're in a familial trafficking setting because they're protected by the bloodline. In a non-familial trafficking situation, you know, they're not necessarily protected by the bloodline, but most people still will not listen to a teenager when they say, hey, this happened. That happened in the Epstein case. And had we listened or vetted it out, maybe things would have been different. But again, money, power, politics took care of that.
Well, Andy, you are such a wonderful person. We definitely have to have you come back on. And if you can send me legislation, I can get the ball rolling here in South Carolina. And if I can do it, then others listening in onto the show can also start the ball rolling in their states. And maybe we can make this a bucket brigade to help start quelling
the
fire.
That would be great. That would be great. And if someone's struggling, they can go to our website. There's helplines and hotlines. Just go to voicesagainsttrafficking.com, and there's a whole list of things that can be helpful to someone who's been hurt or who's thinking of hurting someone.
Well, thank you, Andy. And again, I'll get a hold of Vicki, send me the stuff over, and we'll have you back again.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. It's been an honor.
Take care. All right. Check out voicesagainsttrafficking.com as well as Beulah's Place. There's links up on the show page. Just click on them and give her a hand. She's a marvelous, marvelous lady. She had me in tears at one point. That said, now hopefully we turn those tears into laughter. One of my favorite, I should say my favorite, from Heritage Foundation, Hans von Spakovsky. Good afternoon, Hans. You're our final victim of the day, as usual.
Final victim on a Friday. Yeah, okay. I'm ready. I can live with that.
Oh, my goodness. I was starting to put notes together for you last night, and I got to tell you, the stack of printouts I have next to me of different articles, things I've circled, underlined, highlighted, is about a quarter inch thick. No kidding.
Wow.
So, I mean, the news cycle is hitting us nonstop with one thing after another. And every time I look at it, it goes, I got to talk to Hans about this. I got to talk to – holy moly, what new trick do they have up their sleeve today? You know, we had our county GOP meeting last night, and I'm on not just the executive committee but the resolution committee. So we had formed one to object to HR1. And then I get home, I pull up the article that you wrote just a couple of days ago, and I'm going, oh my goodness. So this resolution really doesn't mean anything because they're going to pull SR1 and HR1 off the table, and they're going to substitute S2093. It's a little game of hide and seek. No trick. Tell us about SR1, HR1, and what is now the substitute S2093.
Well, fortunately for the moment, it's dead, because what happened when they put the substitute in, and the substitute had cosmetic changes. It didn't really have any substantive changes. So it was basically the same bill. But it's dead for the moment because on Tuesday of this week, Chuck Schumer brought it to the floor. And the Republicans filibustered it, and the Democrats did not have enough votes to overcome the filibuster. So basically the bill for right now is dead. Unless Schumer tries to bring it back at some point in the future, a different version, a different bill, the Republicans successfully filibustered it. Now, as you know, there's an old saying, there are no permanent victories in Washington. And we already see moves by liberals and Democrats to keep this battle going on trying to basically make our elections less secure and less fair. They've already got another bill in the line they want to bring up. And I don't know if you saw it, but today, just a little while ago, U.S. Justice Department actually sued Georgia over its election reform bill that tried to fix a lot of problems in their system. And so that's their other avenue of attacking our election rules, is they're now going to start suing states who have tried to reform the election process.
This is so crazy, because Merrick Garland made a threat against that in his speech. And my husband and I just stood and looked at the TV, just shaking our heads like, you know, what other things would they invade in? What part of state sovereignty do they not understand?
Yeah, and it's not just that, but it's that, like, this latest lawsuit, which I've just finished looking at, it really is a frivolous lawsuit. And I'll give you a quick example of what I mean. Look, Georgia's had a voter ID law in place since 2008. Now, it only applied to in-person voting. And so what they did as part of their election reform bill just a couple of months ago was they extended their voter ID requirement to absentee balloting. Now, this latest lawsuit by DOJ says, oh, you can't do that. That's racially discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. Well, there's two big problems with that. First of all, when Georgia passed its voter ID law more than a decade ago, the ACLU and others filed a lawsuit against that voter ID law, claiming it was racially discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act, and they lost. Second of all, Alabama actually a couple of years ago passed an ID law that applied to both in-person and absentee balloting. All Georgia did recently was basically copy what Alabama did and extend their ID requirement to absentee ballots. Alabama got sued with virtually the same claim that Merrick Garland is making this lawsuit today, that was discriminatory. And that lawsuit was thrown out last year by the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. So the idea that having an ID law that applies to both in-person and absentee balloting is discriminatory, it's been decided in the 11th Circuit. Well, guess, besides Alabama, what other state is part of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals? Georgia. So this has already been decided by courts of appeal, and yet here they make this claim in this lawsuit, and they're going to get a lot of publicity from the New York Times or everybody else, that they don't have a right to be making because it's already been decided.
You know, here in South Carolina, under Nikki Haley, we started the voter ID. You know, we made it official.
Yeah.
Voter ID.
Right.
So they tried to say, no, and they tried to sue. Of course, they did not win because Nikki Haley turns around and goes, okay, I'm opening up free transportation for any of these underprivileged areas you claim I'm going to disenfranchise, I'm going to offer them free transportation to motor vehicles, and they can get a free state ID. And so something like, I don't know how many million, 3 million supposedly would be disenfranchised. And I think it was maybe 200 people that used the free transportation. So wait a minute. You're telling us either they're too dumb or too poor to get to DMV, so we offer them free transportation and free ID, and what's the problem here now?
Well, there isn't one, but look, South Carolina actually gives you a good example of how abusive the Justice Department is, because at that time, remember, it was the Obama administration, and South Carolina had to go to court to get its voter ID law into effect against the Obama Justice Department. And South Carolina won, but I think it cost them something like $3 million in attorney's fees, the Obama Justice Department, with its absurd claims that your ID law was somehow discriminatory. Well, that's exactly what's now unfortunately going on again, because you know, now we have the Biden administration, and we have a liberal like Merrick Garland in charge of the Justice Department. So they're using the same technique of suing Georgia, even though they really don't have a case, because they know it's going to cost the state a lot of money to defend their election reform bill. And they're hoping that the case will get assigned to some liberal Obama-appointed federal judge who's going to rule in favor of the Justice Department despite the evidence in the case.
Well, yeah, I got to say something here for South Carolina, because our attorney general is Alan Wilson. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
You know, his dad was
my congressman.
Good guy. Yeah, Alan, we have a running joke between the two of us. But he said, Ann, don't worry. I see the lawsuits coming. We got our guys already on it. We're looking at 15 ways sideways, and we got a game plan. So far, every time they've attacked us, Alan Wilson and his team have beat them back. The latest attack was where we doing the absentee ballot, and they said, well, if you send the ballots out absentee and you don't put a stamp on it, it's a poll tax, so you can't do that. So what they did was they just said, okay, we'll pay for the postage. we'll pay the return postage, so there's no poll tax. But, you know, they will think of anything and everything to break down the requirements for legal voting.
And unfortunately, we see that going on now. Unfortunately, this Georgia case may be just one of many cases filed by the Justice Department, particularly because you probably saw this, but in the speech Merrick Garland gave 2 weeks ago, he promised to double the staff at the Justice Department of the lawyers who enforce the Voting Rights Act and federal voting laws. Well, the only reason for that is to try to make trouble for states that have passed election reform measures, and that's clearly what they intend to do. They're going to try to achieve through the courts what they couldn't achieve in Congress.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling because the Constitution gives the states the power over the elections. So, you know, you're seeing states like here in South Carolina tightening their voter requirements. Florida, Texas, Georgia's now trying. Pennsylvania passed their voter reform, even though the governor said that he's going to veto it. And they have enough to overturn Tom Wolf's veto and put it in effect. So this brings me into my next question. Why can't we evoke the 10th Amendment and say hands off our elections?
Well, you can to some extent, but not because, look, the Constitution has more than one provision dealing with federal elections. And the power with regard to federal elections is divided between Congress and the states. So there are some things that Congress can do. I mean, for example, as you know, the dates for federal elections in November, that's according to federal law set by Congress. And Congress has the power to do that. They can set the time, place, and manner of federal elections. But other powers are given to the states, such as determining your eligibility to be able to vote. And so, like I said, responsibilities are divided between the two states, between the states and Congress. So it's not quite as easy an issue as just citing the 10th Amendment.
All right, because I know there's moves to make sanctuary states. Now, South Carolina is sanctuary state for Second Amendment. Florida also. But now Florida, there's a movement down there to make it a sanctuary state for the Bill of Rights to cover all bases. Do you see a movement for that to help protect our rights?
Well, some states actually have better protections than the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution. And so that's always a good, that's normally a very good thing when states do that.
Well, I think Florida's got the right idea. DeSantis down there is fantastic. I just wish we had 49 more like him. And have the guts to stand up to this administration and do the right thing. But, you know, the voting rights, people don't understand how important this is. Now, even though you still have the audit going on in Georgia, Arizona, and I forget everywhere, Pennsylvania, this election will not be overturned because once the Electoral College votes, that's it. So what's the end result then of these audits? Some people are going to go, what's the purpose of them if the election's not going to be overturned?
Well, the purpose isn't really any different than the kind of audits that businesses routinely undergo all the time, which is why I really don't understand the opposition to it. But I think every state ought to conduct audits. Well, the point of an audit is to ensure, one, that all the rules, laws were followed in the election by election officials, and second, that the voting equipment, for example, functioned the way it should. And the whole point here is to find any problems that occurred, any potential misbehavior, so that you can fix it and remedy it. And look, if you find intentional misbehavior, while you can't overturn the election, intentional misbehavior, if it violates a state or federal law, might be prosecutable. And look, I can give you a quick example of this. You talked about the audits that have been getting media attention, but there's been almost no media attention of an audit recently conducted in Windham, New Hampshire, of a small town there. And you know what they found? They discovered that computer scanners that they used to read paper ballots were misreading absentee ballots. They were misreading the ballots to the point where in a local election, the winning candidates were not credited with 300 votes that they actually received from voters. And the losing candidate, who they thought had only lost by 24 votes, in fact, had lost by 100 votes. So this was, there was no intentional misconduct. There was a problem with their computer scanners that count votes. If they had not, it didn't change the outcome of this of last year's election, but if they hadn't conducted this audit, they wouldn't know that they've got a problem with their voting equipment that needs to be fixed before the next election, because in a future election, it could potentially make the difference.
Well, now, in Arizona, there was a fight between whether or not to have a third audit. But there's a difference, because the first two audits were a regular audit, and then Arizona Senate said, no, we want a forensic audit. What's the difference between the two?
Well, some audits, all they do is recount the votes. They recount the votes by hand and see if that matches the computer totals that were given. Well, that might tell you if the computer equipment is malfunctioning like happened in New Hampshire, but that's not going to tell you whether, for example, there were ballots cast in the election by people who are registered to vote in your state but who don't actually live there. And a forensic audit is supposed to go into a much more detail to not only check that the votes were properly counted, but, for example, to check the voter registration list and try to ensure that people who are registered are actually real people, they're not fake registrations, and that people who are dead didn't cast a ballot. I mean, there's all kinds of things like that that you would check in a detailed forensic audit.
Well, now, this leads to a comment that's up in the chat room by our friend Joe, and it said, if Arizona does decertify the results in a few days and reverse its official results, it would eliminate Democratic control of the Senate. So it won't affect the presidential race, but it may affect the outcome of other elections.
No, he's not correct about that, because in every state, there are very short statutory deadlines for filing an election contest. In other words, if you are a losing candidate, but you contest that you actually won the election, you only have a short amount of time in which to file a lawsuit contesting the results. And once that deadline is passed, you're not going to – the election is not going to be restaged, and the outcome is not going to be changed. The only thing you can do with an audit like that, like I said, is one, correct mistakes or potentially investigate and prosecute somebody if they engaged in criminal misconduct.
Sounds like Stacey Abrams. We only wish, right? But they are investigating her down in Georgia, something with fudging the ballots. I'm sure has your head shaking. Because in Washington, D.C., they changed There was a change in the way in which people who are eligible to vote. And I read this thing that was up in Judicial Watch, and I just was shaking my head. The city of Washington, D.C. changed it so that it was legislation, actual legislation they passed, that allows convicted convicts to not only vote, but to run for office. And this passed I'm sorry, I'm trying not to laugh, but this is sad at the same time. They have a freshly elected public official named Joel Kasten, who's been in prison for 26 years and is still incarcerated. He got, like, I think a 48-year sentence for first-degree murder. And five other inmates ran also. So now they elected him to this position of Advisory Neighborhood Commission, which advises the D.C. Council and other local entities involving matters ranging from liquor license to public safety. They just put a convicted murderer who's still behind bars and will be behind bars for at least another, 22 years?
Another two decades. And this is the District of Columbia that thinks that it should be a state, that it allows not only people who are in prison to vote, but to run for office, including convicted murderers. Can you think of a better argument for why this the district should not be a state? And it makes you question. Remember, D.C.'s got a mayor, it's got a city council, but that's only because, you know, decades ago, Congress decided to allow them to have home rule instead of Congress running the city. And, you know, it's things like that that really make you wonder whether Congress did the right thing.
Oh, man. I mean, I was just shaking my head. And it's like not just one, but six convicts ran. So, you know, it begs to wonder. Oh, so that means that the convicts in that prison were the ones that voted for them. So now this guy, Joel, probably turns around and goes, you know, I'll get you a couple of squares if you vote for me. If anyone doesn't know what a square is, it's a cigarette, you know, or I won't shiv you if you go and vote for me. So, you know, talk about vote tampering. I mean, I just shook my head when I was reading this. Unbelievable. So in other words, Washington, D.C. can put a candidate forward for president of the United States, technically.
Well, yeah, they could. But I saw that article, too, and I just shook my head over it. But that's, you know, what's interesting about this is, remember, the District of Columbia is, of course, a overwhelmingly Democratic jurisdiction. And, look, this really goes along with the movement of liberals all over the country, mostly Democrats, to push restoring the ability to vote to felons of all kinds, no matter what they've been charged and convicted of. And they're so desperate to stay in power that they want the votes of criminals who have victimized society. And now they are in the District of Columbia, they're like actually saying, oh yeah, you can get elected to office too.
Yeah. Now I do also follow certain things because, you know, I'm big on religious liberty. And SCOTUS has been making some amazing, amazing rulings. For example, they voted in favor of Catholic Charities against the silly city, Philadelphia, in an issue about foster care and same-sex families. But at the same time, this poor baker up in Colorado, not too much difference between those states lately, this guy Phillips, refusing to make a cake for a transgender for their outing. And that was followed by an IRS ruling against a church in Houston when the pastor said, you know, pray for our elected officials. He didn't say pray for Democrats or Republicans, just say pray for our elected officials. So the IRS deemed it no longer a nonprofit because you're praying for Republicans, therefore Democrats cannot be Christians. So when you look at those three different rulings, these other two go towards the Supreme Court in light of the Catholic Charities. Do you see the Supreme Court then siding with the plaintiffs in this?
Well, certainly in the Colorado case, yes. I mean, the court's made it very clear its views on supporting the ability of people to live their lives through their religious beliefs. The IRS issue is one that's going to depend on federal tax law, and I don't know how – I don't know – it's very hard to predict how the Supreme Court would come out on that particular issue. But by the way, you know, we were talking about S-1 earlier that got filibustered in the Senate. You know, S-1 had a provision in it to lift the provisions that the Republicans had managed to get in when they controlled the House and the Senate that prohibited the IRS from engaging in the targeting of conservative nonprofit organizations the way they had done during the Obama administration. So it's very clear that liberals want to empower the IRS to go after organizations for partisan political purposes. They want to use the IRS as a political weapon.
Well, didn't they say that they are now hiring more IRS agents for auditing purposes? Matter of fact, when they went after the Tea Parties, I'm trying to think the year, that was 2012, because my friend Joe Dugan and Diane were the ones that testified before Congress. At that point, we were still debating, because we formed in 2009, whether or not to become a 501c3, and I kept on arguing not to do it, to remain a loosely group of friends, and that way we cannot be touched. If you remember back in, I believe it was 2009 or 10, there was a gentleman out of California in protest to Geithner. He would write on each and every single dollar bill he came across, you know, tax cheat. He had a little stamp, and he would stamp the bills, tax cheat next to Geithner's name. And they went after him, the IRS, you know, auditing him and everything. And I'm thinking that was the dumbest way if you want to put him out of business and silence him. He's defacing an official government document, which is the currency. You know, you can arrest him for that. But no, they used the power of the IRS. And looking at the inaneness of this whole thing, I said, let's not do this. But once again, they're using the IRS to silence our voices.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate trend we're seeing throughout our culture and society today. I mean, not just in government, but in the corporate world and elsewhere. You know, it's all part of this woke and cancel culture. And these trends are extremely scary, and I worry about them a great deal.
It is. Well, Hans, it is always a pleasure. People can find you over at heritage.org, where you also have an area where people can check to see what election fraud that you have verified. It's up on your site. It's not everything, but it's a sampling of what is going on, and you do such hard work over there. We really appreciate you guys. So thank Tom for sending you over here, and you know you're always welcome, baby doll.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and have a nice weekend.
You too. God bless. All right, check out Hans von Spakovsky over at heritage.org. And we're down to our last 2 minutes. I can't believe the show has just gone so fast, so fast. But next week, we're going to start having with us Mark Tapscott, bi-monthly from Epic Times. So with that, I will end it with When the Roll is Called Up Yonder. Until then, I say good night. And God bless. Oh, I think I have to unmute. My bad.
When the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more, and the morning breaks eternal bright and fair, when the saved of earth shall gather over on the other shore, and the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Morning when the dead in Christ rise, and the glory of his resurrection share. When his chosen ones shall gather to their home beyond the skies, and the road